Hello, I'm Jeff Lester, and welcome to Wait, What? A comics and pop culture podcast coming to you from the not-so-solitary fortress that is WaitWhatPodcast.com. Today, Graham McMillan and I are back with a two-and-a-half-hour super punch kick of content as we dig deep into the enigma that is Starbrand, the new universe comic created by Jim Shooter and then destroyed by John Byrne in one of the strangest, pettiest, most ambitious, and yet deranged comic books in existence. But first, before we get to that, we discuss the recent Defenders miniseries on Netflix and the even more recent Adam Wingard U.S. film adaptation of manga classic Death Note. Show notes are available at WaitWhatPodcast.com. Leave us comments and questions at WaitWhatPodcast@gmail.com. And we invite you to look out for us on Twitter, Tumblr, and Patreon. As always, we hope you enjoy, and thank you for listening.
Jeff Lester.
Graham McMillan, hello.
Do you have a new microphone?
I have a new headset. How does it sound, okay?
It sounds wonderful.
Oh, good.
Great. Much better than last week. We'll see if 20 minutes in something terrible happens.
Exactly. So, but hopefully it'll all be groovy. So, yes. Well, excellent. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being on. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Thanks for inviting me on. I think it's really impressive that you've done the show for years now. Yeah. And you've had an incredible array of guests.
It's true. I have to say, there's been you and that's it. Oh, no, wait. Brian.
I was going to say, there's a Hips episode.
I know. Poor Brian. I was like, am I going to diss him? So, Graham McMillan, we have so much to talk about. Stunning. It is stunning how much comic book shit-talking we are going to be doing for the next 2 hours. Just remarkable.
Are you saying this because of Starbrand, or are you saying this in addition to Starbrand?
In addition to Starbrand. This terrifying thing is we're going to be talking about Starbrand for hours. But, oh, yes, absolutely.
What is the other shit?
Oh, man, what isn't the other shit, Graham?
No, light it up, Jeff. Light it up right now.
I want to talk to you about a little waste of time. An amazing waste of resources, humanity, and human effort called the Defenders.
I have to be honest, Jeff. I made it through two episodes.
Oh, shit.
When I say I made it through two episodes, what happened is someone was like, I was like, I think I'm going to watch the Defenders. And someone was like, just go straight to episode three.
Right.
Skip episode one and two altogether.
Right.
Just go straight to episode three. And I did. And then I fast forward through most of episode three.
Yeah.
And then I was like, sure. Like, they've all finally fucking met now. I'll watch episode four. And then I fast forward through a lot of episode four. And then I thought, this show is not for me.
You know.
But knowing you, you probably watched the whole fucking thing.
I did. And the first two episodes, I was like, oh, okay. Like, it's kind of sluggishly paced, but it'll pick up. And you and I talked and you're like, yeah, try episode three. And, you know, so then we watch episode three. I'm like, okay, so they're all meeting and they do that little thing with the color combination. So,
but let's just talk about this. Episode three, where I've been told by actually many people, oh, it's the one where they all meet and it gets good. Mm-hmm. So many people were lying to me. Not only because it gets good is clearly untrue.
Right.
But also, it's the one where they meet, sure, but no one said you're going to have to sit through like 40 minutes of fucking Elektra backstory.
Well, the thing
that is like, yeah. Astoundingly dull and slow that even when you're watching it, you're like, it's kind of like, have I been drugged and I'm watching it previously on, but my sense of time has been completely fucked with?
Yeah.
And it's just taking a really long time? Cause that's what the show felt like.
Yes. No, and that is precisely what was amazing to me about it was and this is stunning to me, is that Marvel started off with this plan, you know, we're going to create the four TV shows and then we're going to bring them into the four and then we're going to bring them into the Defenders miniseries. And what I think is fascinating is that when they put that idea together, they kind of were like, okay, so we kind of got this. We have a little bit of that. They had one idea that they jotted down for the Defenders, I think, which was kind of like, yeah, they come together and they have to fight Elektra in the Hand, right? And you sort of figured as they got closer to the show, they would have more time to flesh out that idea. And what is stunning to me is the Defenders is literally 8 episodes that could have been a 2-hour movie because they brought nothing else. They literally developed not a single thing. Like, you know where you're watching, like, and this is perhaps unsurprising considering, one of the showrunners worked on Buffy, but like, remember that feeling in like a Buffy season where they've got the big bad established, but it's still like 6 it's episodes like to the finale?
Yeah, I was gonna say it's episode 16.
Yeah, exactly.
And they start doing filler.
Yeah, so it is entirely like those 6 issues for the episodes for the entire run of the Defenders. They are killing time until the last episode. People speak slowly. There's episodes that start off, I swear to God, I don't remember if it's episode 3 or if it's episode 4, but there's that episode that starts off with the gorgeous music playing and you see the bad guy sort of assemble and they're walking through all the places just to show up. I think they just, it's the beginning of episode 4, right?
I was going to say that's neither episode 3 or 4 because I didn't see that scene.
Oh, okay. It's a gorgeous piece of music, but it's literally, there is so much stalling. Like Sigourney Weaver just gets out and says the same dull shit. Everyone throughout the entire thing says the same dull shit over and over and over again.
Can we talk about how bad the dialogue is in this show? I mean, don't get me wrong. Not one Marvel TV show has had good dialogue. Not one of them.
I disagree.
Really?
Yeah.
Which one? Which one is good dialogue?
I don't necessarily know if it's good. Yeah, I would say that the first season of Daredevil hits a sweet spot between dialogue that is witty, a little stylized, and again, in a very Whedon-y kind of way, which is not surprising because at that point it was Drew Goddard who had also done a bunch of Whedonverse stuff.
He left after the first episode.
Whoever
took over was another Whedon guy, though, wasn't he?
I don't think so. It was the Spartacus guy. Like, they brought in Petrie and Ramirez for the second season of Daredevil. They've got what's his name, who was like the Blood of Spartacus guy, whose name I forget.
I'm looking him up right now.
Yeah,
it was.
And I don't give that guy enough credit, probably.
Stephen DeKnight.
Right, Stephen DeKnight. I don't give Stephen DeKnight enough
credit. Yeah, he did. He did Buffy the Vampire Slayer. He did Angel.
Oh, did he? Okay.
He did Dollhouse, didn't he? Mm-hmm.
Who knows? I did not mention Dollhouse.
He's done a bunch of Whedon stuff.
Yeah. So anyway, so these are Whedon-y guys, right? But I thought the stuff in Daredevil, there was stuff that was actually truly witty, and the performances by people were actually really good. I know it was not your thing, but you may or may not remember,
yeah. I thought that Daredevil season 1 was not my thing, but was very well done for what it was.
Oh, okay. That's good. Cause I remember you saying things like, I think I preferred season 2, which is like then I stabbed myself in the eardrums to keep you from talking.
So. Oh, that's okay. Cause that was when I'd only seen like 2 episodes of season 2 and then I saw more and I was like, nope.
Okay.
Nope. I have to this day still not finished an entire season of any of the Netflix Marvel shows.
It's interesting. I don't think, well, like you said, on the one hand, they're sort of kind of not your thing, but at least I think for myself, I think season 1 of Daredevil, one of the big problems with it is it really tricked people into thinking that it could be done. Like Daredevil, that first season of Daredevil, you're like, oh, like a lot of the choices that were made were choices that were made with the idea that you were going to have a TV show, and that it was like a TV series, you know what I mean? And it had larger kind of story points that it was going to go to clearly with the stuff with Elektra and what have you. But the second season of Daredevil is kind of where the blight really kicks in. And I mean, I don't know, I'm not the best person to talk because I liked 75% of Jessica Jones, which everyone seemed to love, and about 30% of
You were super into Luke Cage's first few episodes.
I was like,
I talked to you after you'd seen like maybe 3 or 4 of those episodes, and you were really? Like, oh, oh my, man. Yeah, and you were really into it.
Interesting.
You were like, you've got to watch this. You know, I think they've hit on something. I think they're really doing it right. And then I remember I talked to you the next week, and you're like, "Oh, that was shit."
Yeah, that
and it was
true.
Funny
yeah.
because it completely retroactively changed your opinion of the first few episodes. Totally but you were sense. Super into it for the first few episodes.
I believe it. I do believe it because there was some stuff. If nothing else, just some of the color, the fact that they were working in ongoing musical performances, just a lot of stuff that was kind of like, "Wow, you're doing some weird shit with this show." And of course, the performance by what's his name, who went on to
Ben
be
Coulter.
Amazing is that the lead?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's not who I'm talking about. Although he's quite good. The guy who plays, there's the thing that I thought was, in retrospect, kind of smart about Luke Cage that I don't think that they didn't handle it well, but it was such a good idea, was that they stacked their supervillains on top of each other. So there were three of them in the series, and each one built on top of them, on top of it. But it was,
the guy who's since gone on to star in Moonlight.
Yeah, right? exactly.
Yeah, and then he was in, he was just announced for something. I can't remember what it was.
And he is fucking terrific. And of course, why do they, is it Mahershala Ali.
Ali,
who played Cottonmouth. He was great, and that's part of why the first couple of episodes are, you're like, holy shit, this is going to be amazing. And then the writers are like, nah, just kidding, we don't know what we're doing. And
then you had Iron Fist, which was clear from episode one that they had no idea what they were doing.
Oh, no, I mean, the don't know what they're doing, like, I guess is...
Iron Fist is terrible show.
Oh, it's so bad.
It's so bad that I know people who like the rest of the Marvel shows who couldn't make it any further than like two episodes of Iron Fist.
That was me. I couldn't make it. I've made it. I took it as personal triumph that I made it to episode two. Unless I made it to episode three. No, I think it was only episode two. That was god awful. I mean, and what's fascinating to me is how much of Defenders builds
is Iron Fist.
Yeah, is really tied to the Iron Fist stuff. So part of it is kind of this enormous mistake that's made in terms of tying everything onto, you know, the extremely uncharismatic, barely functional Finn Jones having to carry sort of be sort of the heart of the show, really, and give him too much to do, and everyone else is kind of just hanging out. But the fact of the matter is that the show is just, it's literally killing time. From the first episode, it's killing time to get to the last episode. I mean, stunning.
Jump back for a second. Mm-hmm. One of the things that fascinated me about making Iron Fist the center of the show was that Iron Fist was also the only sincere character in the show, because every other fucking Marvel character is, you know, cynically cool and detached and quippy.
Okay, all right. I thought
that it was really interesting for me to have Iron Fist be the butt of the joke in the two episodes I saw.
Mm-hmm.
Like, repeatedly.
Yeah.
Because he was so sincere, and he was like, I'm Iron Fist, I'm the immortal Iron Fist from Kun Lun, and everyone was like, ha ha, loser.
Right.
And it was so weird. It was so amazingly self-conscious.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's funny, I didn't really dislike Jessica Jones, but I didn't like Jessica Jones either, the series.
Mm-hmm.
But episode four Defenders, like, actively turned me off watching any, like, giving any more chance to season two.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because I thought that she, both in terms of character and performance, came across as so amazingly unlikable.
Interesting.
The end of episode four, where she comes back and she's like, "Did you miss me?" I was like, "I never want to see you on television."
Yeah, no, it's true. She is pretty. There's a couple of lines.
She's been far too hard on, like, the, "Oh, I know who this is. She's the damaged girl one." You know, that I was just like, "Oh shit, no!" Like, this is terrible. In the same way with Daredevil and the, "I'm not going to get involved. I can't get involved. I'm not going to get involved. I can't get involved. I'm not going to." And I was just like, fucking fuck.
Yeah.
We know, like, literally, it's an 8-episode show, and we know you're forming a fucking super team. Yeah. Do not drag this out. But of course, they dragged everything out.
Everything got dragged out. It's amazing how much shit. It was like they made a list of stuff that they thought worked from previous parts of all the different shows and then kind of assembled them, but like without, like literally, it was as if they watched the first season of Daredevil and all those shots of the Kingpin, eating food while listening to music and, basically delivering speeches to other people about, you know, basically about how important he is and how he's not a bad guy. They're like, oh, okay, we'll just copy that. We'll have Sigourney Weaver do the same thing. And we're not, I mean, it literally was, I don't know if they were basically told like they had 8 hours of TV that they had to write in 6 hours or what they did. But I mean, that show, I was just stunned. I was like, this is, cause I mean, it was, there have been stuff that I watched that I liked about the Marvel shows. There have been things that I disagreed with or things that I thought were handled poorly. After the second season of Daredevil, knowing that it was the same showrunners, I was like, there's no way that the Defenders can be good. But the thing that was really sad to me is that there are people on the show that are trying, and some of those people are the actors. Some of those people are like the lighting guy spent way, way, way too much time thinking about the color palette choices. Like, the color palette choices are really, you can see parts where people are doing what they're supposed to be doing, which is working hard, but it's literally just all a waste because at the end of it, the people who are running it are just like, are literally running out the clock for 8 hours. It's very hard to watch, watching through
the other 6 hours. Cannot. My takeaway, honestly, mm-hmm. was I feel bad for Sigourney Weaver and Scott Glenn, whose careers are apparently in such bad trouble that they agreed to do this.
Well, Scott Glenn, yeah, I mean, sure. But, I mean, Sigourney Weaver's really interesting, too, because they were like, oh, she's going to class up the joint. And I mean, you know, I'm sure she was kind of... Sigourney Weaver's got some interesting stuff going on with her. You know what I mean? Like, we could probably
I'm glad you think that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, but it was interesting watching her in this and be just like, I honestly had so many flashbacks to the Dungeons and Dragons movie, you know, cause I don't know if you saw that, but like.
I did not. To be honest, I never will.
Well, my brother Tim talked me into renting it with him and it is amazingly bad. But one of the things that's awesome about it is like the behind the scenes videos is they actually have a scene. They're like while the directors and writers are talking about how awesome everything is, they're showing a scene where Jeremy Irons is acting against a green screen, and it's like him acting, and then they call cut, and you just see the life leave his body. Like you see Jeremy Irons be like his body just sags under the what. Terrible life choices have led me here. And yet when the camera's rolling, of course, Jeremy Irons
is acting. Yeah.
But kind of in an unhinged way. And so it's interesting watching Sigourney Weaver, like admittedly, you're just so bored. You can project all sorts of stuff into these people, but there are points where I would just swear that Sigourney Weaver is, you can just see her in her mind saying, I'm a professional. I'm a professional. I'm a professional. I'm a professional.
Oh, if so, then she's a professional. Like her performance in this, or again, in the two episodes I saw, her performance was stunningly phoned in.
But she has nothing to work with. She has
nobody has anything to work with.
Well, no, of course not. And what's interesting is she wasn't even trying
to bring anything to it, I guess is what I'm saying. Like, I think that some of the main cast were, mm-hmm. you know, but Sigourney Weaver, just seemed like she was there to collect the check. That was it.
Well, I feel that in that sense, she accurately reflects the what was going on behind the scenes for the showrunners. Because I mean, it really is just. I think she was being like, "Oh yeah, no, this is going to pay off. I'm sort of the woman of mystery for whom you find out who I really am and what I've really done." And they're like, "No, no, 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 no." I mean, I don't want to get into spoilers too much, but like,
well, I know what happens to her character because. Okay. Thanks, internet. Yeah. The show's been out a week, and of course someone's just going to put, like, yeah. what happens in a headline.
Yeah, so...
Because, great. Again, not going to watch the episodes. It's not like I'm like, oh, you ruined it for me. But at the same time, it's been out, like, a week, yeah. and I saw that headline, and I was right. like, seriously? This is ridiculous.
You know what? Honestly, it wouldn't surprise me if the Marvel people called them and begged them to get that out there. You know what I mean? Because it's just such a, like... We've got to make it sound like there's something that happened in this show. Like there's been a whole sweep of stories that are kind of like so-and-so talks about the choices made in the Defenders. Spoilers, you know? And I was like, which was interesting because watching the show, I was like, okay, so what would they be talking about? And finally in the last two episodes, you're like, oh, there was that decision and that decision, or maybe three episodes. But
and it's going to be like, there was that decision and that decision. And one of them, Matt decides to put on his Daredevil costume.
Yeah, right.
You know, maybe, but you can tell that the Defenders was not particularly embraced, even by the core fan base, mm-hmm. by the fact that, really, the weekend after it was released, it was dominated by the Punisher trailer at the end.
Oh, where was that? I never even saw that.
It's the after credit sequence in the last episode.
Oh, it was so funny because I was watching it being like, oh, I guess they photoshopped in the Punisher. Like, I must have gotten confused because I'd heard that he appeared and I was like, oh, okay, so they're going to end it with that. And then at a certain point, I was literally like, oh, maybe it's an in the middle of the credit sequence, but I'm like, A, I don't care. And of course, the great thing is that I don't know how everyone else watches Netflix, but...
Are you going to say that Netflix, like, after halfway through the credits, just skipped to something else?
Yes! I mean, that's yes. the thing. You would
it's
think
the
they
funniest
would change
thing.
That.
Having, a,
yeah.
having a post-credit sequence when Netflix will not let you watch the end of the credits unless you actively choose to
exactly.
is the funniest thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Unless you A, know that it's coming, or B, you're like... And I mean, who knows?
Well,
maybe they'll like
it. I think that is... I think that is something where Marvel did try and get that out because they realized that. Like, you have to tell people, watch to the end of the fucking credits in the final episode.
Right, right.
Even then, like, you and I have gone back and forth before about my distaste about The Punisher. Mm-hmm. But watching that trailer, I was like, and there's another show I'm not even going to watch an episode of.
Oh, yeah. No, no, I mean, the whole thing is kind of... The thing that I think is interesting to me, Graham, is that there's stuff with Luke Cage, the way they try and handle Luke Cage. And honestly... If there had been a drop of talent involved in the Iron Fist show, and honestly, I should qualify that, drop of talent behind the scenes at the showrunner level. I mean, you know, the first two episodes of Iron Fist are directed by John Dahl, for fuck's sake. You know, that's the guy who did, like, The Last Seduction and has
right?
done some amazing work. And the first two episodes of Iron Fist are excruciating in how badly they're written and how badly they're performed. Like, it used to be that, like, with the Marvel shows, it was kind of like, oh, we've got, like, a surprisingly deep bench. Like, people might totally disagree with me, and I would kind of get it, but, like, first season of Daredevil, you've got some really good actors in some really sort of, you know, like, you're kind of like, Foggy Nelson or Karen Page. And the actors are better than the material by far. By the time you get to Iron Fist, I was like, this show has to live and breathe, as every TV show does, kind of on your characters, and all your actors are shitty, except maybe Colleen Wing, or maybe she's shitty. I don't know. I mean, again, only made it through two episodes of that, maybe three, and I blocked out the third from the psychic pain. But she pops up in the Defenders a lot. Rosario Dawson pops up in the Defenders a lot. People get together and say things that are literally someone wrote down on a whiteboard. Again, it's just to-do lists. Like, okay, what's Colleen Wing's arc going to be? How's that going to get resolved? Oh, we'll have Rosario Dawson tell her stuff that will make her,
I thought you were going to say, They're going to say the dialogue was what they wrote on the whiteboard, because it felt like that at times.
Oh, it kind of was, yeah.
Like, Rosario Dawson shows up and she's like, I think you two should meet. You're on the same side. I'm going to leave you alone to get to know each other. Walks out.
Yeah, no, it really is. It is stuff. Like, it is the, no, you are the base, Colleen. You are the foundation. Double underline in blue highlighter. You know, it's just, ugh.
Now, you watched the entire Defenders, right?
Yeah.
Miss Knight presumably shows up at some point, and does she meet Colleen?
She does. She does, and interestingly enough, they end up in a room together, and there's some spoilery type stuff that would not...
Do they say something like, you look like a daughter of the dragon? And yeah. Misty's like, look at my new robot arm! You and I should form Nightwing Investigations. I have a robot arm. You have some horribly generic racist backstory. Why don't we get together and fight crime in a show that will never be made because, ha ha, we're both women.
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of interesting with Marvel because, of course, they're sowing their seed all over the place. But those pieces are in place. And honestly, if they were smart, they should just go ahead and do it because, as far as I can tell, people like... Those actors were definitely cast with an idea of, we're going to reuse them and again, sort of it's TV. Kind of like, why not? If the fans are into it, we can make this happen. Whether or not they will or not, I mean, that's the thing. Marvel TV, clearly the Defenders is the biggest sign yet. That they did not think things through when they pinned the deal, and they basically completely, I thought they completely failed, which was amazing because that, again, for me, watching the first season of Daredevil, even little bits and pieces of the other series, I really liked two-thirds, three-quarters of Jessica Jones in a way that I don't know if they'll ever be able to replicate, but the rest of it has just been like, it's kind of like everything else. You got to get the right people. And when you do, you sort of have to try and keep the right people. And they clearly were just kind of like, okay, you know, who's Joss Whedon's next cast off that we can get? And I mean, that's incredibly super cynical because I know that thanks to the miracle of leaked Sony memos, there was a lot of coverage about how much work Drew Goddard tried to do to exit Daredevil properly and make sure that it was set up with people, and setting it up with Douglas Petrie was definitely something that he was like, this is a good choice, he's the right person for the material, and et cetera, et cetera. You know, you don't know, unless he set him up with Steven DeKnight, which again...
No, he did.
It was DeKnight.
Goddard left after
followed
the first season,
yeah,
so it was Goddard exactly. The first season. Yeah.
Yeah. It was Goddard and DeKnight, and again, there was enough stuff in there that whenever anything good popped up, I'm like, oh, that's Goddard, which is funny because there's one episode of The Defenders that is co-written by Goddard, and I was like, oh, okay. And it wasn't much better than anything else that it was. But again, it's that thing of like, you have 8 hours of television and four main characters and a bunch of other fan service secondary characters, and you can do so much with this. And oh my god, it was bad. The amount of time spent on the bad guys, where the bad guys did nothing but squabble and develop themselves in no way. I was like, it is shitty. It was so, there was that character that was running around that they were calling White Hat. Between the fact that there was White Hat and Black Sky, it just showed you, like, how, like, thin the gruel was. Like, they just didn't have time to put anything in the stock. And
yeah, honestly, the part where I think, like, my spirit bailed was, spoilers, everyone, chopping his hand off to escape.
Yeah.
And then, like, it's only ever commented afterwards by Matt's being like, oh, what happened to your hand? Or something like that. Yeah. And it's like, what? This is terrible.
Yeah.
Like, this is the worst thing in the world.
Yeah.
Because you can tell someone, again, in the writer's room was like, he chops off his hands and it's really fucking intense and the show's he's hardcore. Mm-hmm. And then when they get to make the show, they're like, yeah, so you can chop off your hands, but it's like a paper cut. Like, if you just hold on to it, it's fine.
Oh, completely. Completely. I mean, that's always been a... I mean, there's a huge problem with the show that just keeps going on forever is you've got two characters who are super strong and more or less invulnerable, but against a bunch of martial artists, right? And you have this sequence again and again and again, these horribly excruciatingly boring fight scenes, because you just don't know. You're kind of like, well, okay, so Luke Cage can't actually get cut by these swords, but on the other hand, he really can't lay a punch on half these guys. And it it's a shame because, again, I feel like there was usually one sort of standout fight sequence. Even the second season of Daredevil, which is pretty lame, doubled down on the fight sequences in a way that was great. And here, there was literally a scene in the last episode where a sword fight starts between Colleen Wing and her mentor, who really looks like a celebrity hairdresser. You know, hairdresser to the stars, who's apparently a member of the Hand.
Was it Andre, who is, of course, Janet Van Dyne's favorite hairdresser from Burns?
It was him. They refer to it. Yeah, he's like, I'm going to cut your hair now, Colleen. And I'm going to give you the Van Dyne special. It means a lot to people who know what they're talking about. You know, it's a secret language crap. So they're fighting, and Misty Knight gets a phone call. Oh, no, sorry. Rosario Dawson gets a phone call, and she answers the call, and it's literally her talking with Misty Knight, and they're having this super dramatic conversation that, like, so much of the Defenders is them literally just repeating to each other what the audience members know, have known, and know because it's been mentioned four times previously with absolutely no new information involved at all. And the rest of the sword fight is not only happening in the background, but it's hidden behind some, like, pipes and ducks. So you just see a sword in the background and kind of a clang, 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 clang while they're talking. And I'm like, oh, man. And it's, and they, of course, they build it up like this is this huge dramatic thing that is supposed to be super important. And I guess if you watch the Iron Fist show and were emotionally invested in Colleen Wing's character, and part of me was like, hey, the Colleen Wing character can act enough. I'm kind of involved in what's happening. But they were clearly like, no, too much work. Have them fight behind a bunch of ducks. And then later we'll come back. And, you know, the Defenders is really terrible. I'm impressed at how, again, it was one of those things where I just felt saddened by the waste. You know what I mean? Like, just the waste of human effort involved in that. Because there were people at the top who either, for whatever reason, could not do their jobs. Either they really couldn't do their jobs, or they just didn't have the time, or Jeff Loeb came in and was like, no, just this point and all the stuff on the whiteboard. I absolutely...
We have to film
down.
Now.
Yeah, exactly.
We have to shoot right now. We have an attempt to block out the sword fight. Have them fight behind pipes. I honestly would not be surprised if something like that happened.
Some of the grand finale fight scenes that happen, the big finale fight scene in The Defenders, happens in a half-darkened cave where you really can't even see much. Like, it's, yeah, and it's all, it, and you can just, in the background, you're like, come on, people, come on, come on, come on, we gotta get to the Inhumans, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, you know, and,
The Inhumans, made by the man behind Iron Fist.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's in theaters on Friday, Jeff.
Wow, yeah, so, right, so see, that was the thing, they switched it to that super high priority, and Defenders kinda really was treated like, they were just like, oh, it's fine, or, you know what I mean? Like, there was so much of that, just like, oh, it doesn't matter. Yeah.
You say that, but Marvel is, and this is not my story to tell, but I'll tell it anyway. Marvel is reportedly amazingly touchy about Defenders reviews.
Of course they are.
To the point where an outlet, which is not an outlet I work for, just to spread the blame around, I know was blacklisted by Marvel.
Jesus.
For daring to suggest
that
Defenders was not as good as the earlier series. Didn't even say it was bad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's not as good as the earlier series. They were actually blacklisted from all cast interviews.
Yeah. Well,
that,
I mean,
that's why.
Right. Right, because they said that. No, and it's true. I mean, that's the thing. Maybe they think so they thought it was really great.
Not a,
yeah.
Like that's not a company that is, has just decided, like, fuck it, let's just get it out there. Like, that's a company who actually genuinely thought this was a big deal.
They need it to be a big deal. But I think it reminds me of a little bit of, like, what we talk about, what's going on in Marvel Comics, is these are things that are mandated on the whiteboard. There's a bunch of people who work hard to do what they can with the resources available, which are less than anyone thinks. And then they are so stressed out and defensive that they are just shits. Plus, additionally, there's Marvel's gotten a long, long way on bullying, you know? And so it's not surprising that Marvel TV is like, hey, you know what? We'll bully you. We've got, like, the biggest movie franchise after Pixar, or maybe ahead of Pixar.
I would say ahead of Pixar at this point.
Probably. I'm, you know, but... So,
I mean, like, really behind Star Wars, I can't think of anything that's bigger than Marvel.
Right. Right. So there's...
I can't wait to see what the reaction is to Inhumans.
Yeah.
And by the reaction, I mean Marvel's reaction to the inevitable dropping that Inhumans is going to get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll see. I mean, that's the thing that I think is really interesting to me, is that Marvel TV really did, at the beginning of this whole thing, with its arrangement with Netflix, I was like, oh, you know what? This is potentially viable. And now, of course, I'm like, it's not. And it could be that Marvel TV, unlike what Feig had to do with the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which is more or less physically separate it from Ike Perlmutter and be like, look, we're going to retain talent. You know, it's not just we're going to get talent while they're cheap and exploit them. We're going to take talent, find talented people, you know, and hopefully raise them up and then exploit them. I don't know. But in the traditional Hollywood way. And Marvel TV started out with like, yeah, we've got some good people. And then they're just like, okay, who's written for Buffy? Who's written for Dexter? Oh, that guy did like 3 episodes. Like, sure. Let's give him a show. Let's give him Inhumans. You know, there's no real belief in the idea, you know, that the talent is in any way unique. That there is just going to be someone else that's there that's going to be able to, that you're going to be able to exploit and crank something out. And again, that idea that Marvel is like, but it's going to be great because it's Marvel. You know, just that idea that it's Marvel is the corporation and the characters and that's stronger. It's really interesting in a way when we do come back to talking about Star Brand because if I was a really smart guy, I would figure out a way. But I know there's a linkage between what Shooter's thinking of in the new universe and what later happens to Star Brand afterward.
And the whole new universe.
Yeah, I mean, the whole new universe, yeah, exactly.
It's funny that you... and we will pivot to new universe and Star Brand in a second. But... you saying that, you know, we're Marvel, we've got the brand, we've got the characters. I don't think Marvel actually cares about the characters anymore. I think Marvel cares about the brand. I think Marvel thinks that the brand of Marvel
is enough.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's becoming more and more obvious on the TV side. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think the TV side really is acting like the comic side in terms of publicity and in terms of debuting the projects, mm-hmm, in a way that the movie side doesn't. The movie side still tries to promote things based on the things.
Right.
And I feel that the TV side is very much like, it's Marvel!
Mm-hmm.
Sure, Inhumans, whatever. It's fucking Marvel! It's right. In IMAX and it's Marvel! Are you ready? It's the biggest thing ever in IMAX and Marvel!
Right.
Don't pay attention to the badly CGI'd hair.
Well, it's fascinating because there is that little level of... it'll be interesting to see what they're going to prove, but of course the whole nightmare would be if Inhumans ends up opening huge, which let's face it, it will not. And then Marvel TV is able to be like, see, like the Marvel Cinematic Universe people are just, it's just that they've got the Marvel license. Like you can do like like you said, it's Marvel. Like, we're unstoppable. Anyone can do this, basically, as long as it's us. And,
Define opening huge, though, Jeff.
Well, that's
because,
a good question.
Because Inhumans can't, quote unquote, open huge, because it's a limited run.
Right.
Movie.
Yeah.
Like, it's showing in X number of theaters, all of which are IMAX.
Sure.
And it's only showing for, it is limited run. It's like 2 weeks at most, or maybe even less.
Right. Yeah.
So it's it can't be huge.
Right.
And that's very much on purpose.
Right.
Because they know that the audience appetite for this is limited.
Yeah.
Well, especially right. considering like it's going to, what I am more curious about is, what are the broadcast ratings going to be like for the first couple of episodes of Inhumans? Because the hardcore fans are going to go and see it in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, are they then going to tune into the show afterwards, like a month later, and say, well, I've heard there's a couple of extra scenes, that's worth it? Or are they going to not? And mm-hmm. is Inhumans going to, like, die as a result of this?
I don't know. I have to admit, the whole Inhumans thing is just this It's a whole realm of crazy that I have not bothered to follow in any way, and therefore I can't even pretend to understand it, and I can't even really say if I did that I would be able to, but I'd certainly know. I don't know, Graham. I gotta admit, that sounds crazy. I mean, traditionally you'd be like, oh, here's somebody who is so confident that what they have is superior product that they do this sort of limited promo IMAX theater thingy. And that's just going to drive up the ratings for the show, because what they're going to have is the faithful are going to go see it in IMAX and be like, oh my God, that's great. And convince all their friends to watch the show when it debuts. But that seems really unlikely to me. Again, you and I have talked about the miracle of watching the Glenn Larson TV movies for the Battlestar Galactica and Buck Rogers. And maybe if I was more on top of my game, research that and see if that's something. I mean, certainly from the Inhumans footage, you don't get the sense that it was done like the Battlestar Galactica, where Glenn Larson's like, I spent so much money on these fucking special effects, I've got to release it as a movie in the hopes of like recouping some of our money back, you know?
Well, according to Marvel, mm-hmm. and again, of course they're going to say this, they have spent a significant amount of money on the first couple of episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons why is that they knew it was going to be released in IMAX, but also IMAX as a company has put money into the first couple of episodes.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, there you go.
So, we'll see what happens. It strikes me as one of these things that someone thinks of the marketing plan, but the marketing plan is entirely contingent on people coming out of the theater and going, well, that was fucking great.
Right.
And the problem is, I have not seen one person legitimately look forward to the Inhuman show based on the trailers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not even one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. and you still have people on the internet who are going, you know what's fucking great? Secret Empire. Secret Empire is a great comic. I can't believe they're still keeping it up 9 issues in. You know? And even those people aren't saying Inhumans looks great from that footage.
Right. Right. Yeah. Oof. Ugh. Well, anyway, so yeah, Inhumans, that looks terrible, but I'll be very curious. I guess I should go back and watch that Punisher thing, but like,
It's on YouTube.
Well, there we go. As soon as we get off the air, I will go check it out. But part of me is just like, I don't know. You know, I'm sure they can keep going. That's the thing that was kind of amazing with all the Netflix shows is they had figured out a way to like pop in one character and get it two possible franchise characters wedged in there at the same time. And sort of maybe not make it that super intrusive, at least kind of sort of at first. And now of course it's just, you get to the Defenders and it's just a horrible, horrible, horrible closed loop.
The one I'm looking forward to at this point is Runaways. In large part because I've heard a couple of people who've seen the pilot.
Right.
And their response was kind of like, oh, it's actually good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like genuine surprise.
Yeah.
That it was not the disaster that they were expecting it to be. Yeah. And somehow I buy that more than I buy people going, that was the greatest show ever.
Right.
You know, people who were like, oh, I kind of thought it was going to suck and it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Is more interesting. And also the talent on Runaways, or at least in terms of showrunners, mm-hmm. makes me very curious.
Mm-hmm. Who, you know, it shows you how little attention I've been
paying. It's Josh Schwartz and Stephanie Savage who did the OC and Gossip Girl.
Ah, okay. Right. Yeah,
and they could do something.
That's
with it,
a good,
you know,
pedigree.
Like
that, sure. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So we'll see. We'll see what it's like. But that's also starting soon.
Mm. Mm.
And yeah, it's a weird period for Marvel TV. But the Defenders has done nothing to make me go, you know what? Marvel's really shown that it can vary the tone of its shows, and it really knows how to take the best advantage of its real estate, because Defenders just didn't on either level.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I'm not sure that Defenders really could have, in a way. Like, the thing that
either? Because I think Defenders definitely could have done better than 8 issues of filler.
Oh, eight episodes. Absolutely.
If you're telling me that episodes 3 and 4 are basically, like as good as the show gets, then that's a series that someone should have come in and been like, why don't we just make it 6 episodes?
Well, no, I mean... How do I put this? I guess what I'm just saying is that Defenders was shit miserable, and out of 8 hours, there's maybe like, I don't know, 13 minutes that I would call good, maybe 13, you know?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's not high. It's like 3 wisecracks and maybe half a fight scene, and one idea, but to me, I guess what I'm saying is I wasn't necessarily parsing like each of the 4 shows leading up to Defenders, each sort of tried to do different things. And honestly, I think did, like, to lesser or greater degrees. One of the things that's pretty great about Luke Cage is it is very much not Jessica Jones, and Jessica Jones is very much not Daredevil. Part of the problem with Iron Fist and a big flag is kind of the idea that it is both a little bit too much like everything that's come before, and of course, like, terrible in its own right. But like, for me, I'm like, Defenders, the first 2 episodes, part of why I was like, we'll see where it goes, is part of me is like, it's juggling a bunch of different shows, and I'm like, oh, and they were kind of paying attention to the idea of, like, these characters have character arcs, and they're putting them in position to basically carry out those arcs, and then they're just like, but it's just a little too hard to actually develop that stuff and then resolve it. So we're just going to have people talk and talk and talk and talk, and then they'll give each other the speeches that will resolve their character arcs, and then we're set. You know? And so it's just...
Whereas I imagine that when you say they give each other speeches to resolve the character arcs, the speeches are literally someone saying, what you need to resolve your character arc is X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm.
And them going, you're right. Mm-hmm. And then a ninja appears.
Yeah. No, that is pretty much 8 out. That is most of the Defenders, by all means. But I guess what I'm saying is that by its nature, which is they're gathering up all this other stuff, it's not going to be... It would have been a hard chore, and it wouldn't have moved the ball. It's almost impossible to imagine how it would have moved the ball forward, I guess, in a way that we can talk about, like, oh, Runaways, or like, oh, maybe the Punisher will be something different. Like, I'm just saying that Defenders, what's amazing to it is that just like, it failed even by the very lowest of low bars of like, let's get all these characters together, let's have them fight. You know, the stage at which they did that, no one was really into developing. It was just the absolute minimum was done on it. But again, I just don't know, like, I can't guess behind the cogs of the machine. Just the fact that you say that Runaways is doing something completely different, I think that's,
Well, I don't know if it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's just, like, all I know is that people have seen it and they're like, oh, it's actually good. And it's made by people who have done different types of shows.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, and also the source material is so different. Mm-hmm. Like, if Runaways is tonally the same as Defenders, something has gone hideously wrong.
No, exactly. But I'm just saying, like, I think that that's a sign that, you know, that would be a sign that they've done something wrong. But that also sounds a little closer to what you were saying earlier. So I was a little... Let me talk about, as long as this... we should chain this back into Shooter in the New Universe and Starbrand, but before we do... I want to talk about another Netflix thing, unless you don't want me to.
I don't know what you're going to talk about, so I can't say one way or another.
I was getting to that, Graham. I was getting to the end of my sentence.
Where are you, though? Where are you?
Yeah, well, who knows? But I would have given it good odds. I would have given it good gambling odds that I actually, the end of my sentence would have been the Death Flix. Deathflix, the Death Note adaptation.
Oh, Death Note.
Yeah, on Netflix. So,
is it terrible?
Well, see, this is it. Yesterday when I was watching it, I typed like, I'm doing everything that I can not to live tweet it.
I saw that.
Oh, okay. And everyone was like, do it. And I was like, I can't. It's so unfair to people because it just came out and et cetera, et cetera. But I was like, oh, but I'll totally torture Graham with it. And then afterwards I realized, oh, Graham might actually want to watch this because he did actually enjoy parts of Death Note or the first half of Death Note.
I enjoyed a lot of Death Note.
Yeah.
So, and I'm definitely curious to watch it. Or at least I was before I saw the reviews.
Yeah, so the thing...
And again, it comes down to, like, I think life is too short.
Yeah. You think life... Did you say life is too short? Because it sounds like if you're saying, like, light is too short. I'm like, the actor has problems, but...
Life is too short to sit through the, whatever, it's 2 hours of something that, by all reports, adds nothing to the experience of reading Death Note.
Well, you know, the thing that I think is really interesting to me is what, first off, what's stunning to me is it's under 2 hours. It's like, it might be an hour and 40 minutes or just a little over that. I was shocked that somehow it managed to take me like 3 hours to watch the thing, which was a nightmare in and of itself.
But it's not the whole story, right? Because they're already talking about a sequel.
Oh, yeah. No, one of the things that they did that was quote unquote clever was they set it up. Like you can, like they didn't want to tackle too much of the story, so they figured out what seems like a good juicy opening installment. So the thing that I really want to talk about, well, there's a bunch of things I want to talk about. One of the things that I thought was amazing and fascinating about it, and I don't know, I got the impression that people had mentioned this, but if not, Lakeith Stanfield is going to be a huge, huge star. Maybe some people who know him better and have been watching movies are like, you idiot, he is a huge star. But that guy is going to be huge. He plays L, and he does such a fabulous fucking job with it, I thought, which is amazing. The thing that I think was interesting was that the people who did Death Note, and what I wanted to talk about that I found fascinating is, and it's directed and co-written by Adam Wingard, who did The Guest and You're Next, and some really very kind of decent, intelligent horror films that had a certain kind of retro je ne sais quoi and very smart and... is that they made the really mystifying choice to Americanize their choices for how to Americanize Death Note are completely confounding to me. Like, it's like, okay, we've got to have it's got it. So it's set in America, which means that Light he has to be a lovable loser. You know what I mean? Like, it's amazing how much they John Hughes'd up Death Note. Like, it is almost like an unironic version of Heathers toward the end. And that is...
Wow.
Astounding to me. So it was very much like, okay, we have to have Light, who's this guy who's driven for justice. You know, why? Well, his mother died unfairly in an accident. So it's that, but there's no, it's a, it, it, it's a, the first Death Note, one of the things, as you know, that I think really works well about it is that Light is kind of a teenage elitist, you know? Like, he gets the power of the Death Note, and one of the, he doesn't immediately turn around and kill the school bullies. He immediately begins, like, how do I make the world a better place, right? Because I know. Like, one of the things that I think is so smart about Death Note the manga is it takes the moral self-righteousness that teenagers have, this idea, like, I know, you know, that sort of outrage when you start finding out how the world really works, but you don't know why it works the way that it does. You just assume that it's because people are corrupt and terrible and the world is crappy and there's no real, you know, sense of gray. There's literally black and white. You're literally like, oh no, I understand. Like that inherent morality that teenagers have that lead them to, you know, that lead you into that weird world of, say, slasher films or whatever, or EC comic stories where, like, horrors are visited upon the unjust. You know, that framework, I think, makes sense for almost all teenagers. Teenagers go through a period where they think they know what's best for everyone because they've finally seen the world. They're kind of high on the power of their own ability to kind of see past their own horizons as when they were children. And what's amazing is that the people who put together the American version of Death Note are like, absolutely not. That will make no sense. So much of this is cast in this idea that Light is going to be a lovable loser who is very upset because he lost his mother. And then when Ryuk comes and gives him the Death Note, he is going to be sort of tempted by the power of it, but then he's going to be trapped into more or less doing what he does. Because, of course, he's in love with the hot cheerleader who, of course, craves, you know, she's the one who wants to like, rewrite, you know, the world to make it behave and make sense. And so it's kind of like...
I am trying to work out if there's going to be a making an ugh noise right here, because that's horrible.
Oh, yeah. It
I mean, that's horrible.
Yeah. And you know, the thing that's interesting is there are talented people involved. I mean, there is the guy playing Light is Nat Wolff, I think is actually correct for his character. Like that it's a million miles away from the Light of Death Note, but for what he is, I mean, apart from some of the comic choices are kind of But again, by the time you get to L, who's done, and the thing that I think is amazing is all this stuff with L that works really well, it helps that, of course, Lakeith Stanfield is great and committed to the part, but he's also doing Death Note. Like, there's the least amount of deviation with L from the rest of Death Note. And I'm like, it's kind of amazing. I mean, I guess they committed and made it and they were like, oh, I mean, I kind of hope it's enough of a success that they do another film and are kind of like, okay, we got to get it closer to the source material. And one of the things that is amazing, it's an amazing adaptation because of, you know, sometimes you see adaptations that fail because it doesn't have enough, faith in the material. And I'm fascinated by the extent to which the Netflix version of Death Note feels like it is, does not have enough faith in the American audience to actually step outside of Hollywood screenwriter product box. So they do all of the Hollywood screenwriter product box stuff to keep Light being as sympathetic as possible, but everything that it sacrifices for it just ends up changing the tenor so weird. And it's fascinating because at the end of it, as I think is weirdly the case, God, there was something else that I was watching. Baby Driver. Like, I know that Baby Driver is not intended to basically be a white supremacist movie, but it's amazing the extent by which you get to the end of Baby Driver, and I'm like, that ending's a little too white supremacy for me. And sort of by the same token, with Death Note, you've got, oh yeah, Light Turner's a good guy, but, you know, between the evil vagina and the relentless black person persecuting him, what's he gonna do? Am I right? You know? And that's also kind of a weird, like, it's this weird unintended,
That's very uncomfortable.
Yeah, I don't think that, I think the people, all the people involved would be really horrified that that's, they're like, no, that's not what we're trying to do at all. And just the same way that I think Edgar Wright, if I said what I had said about Baby Driver, I was gonna say he'd punch me in the face, but really what he would do was like, list his top 10 favorite punching scenes in movies and explain why they're his favorite. And
wow,
I know, that's such a dick.
You are such a dick.
Jeff Lester, abhorrent human being. Yeah, anyway, that was really unfair. But on the other hand, Baby Driver, the
you're like, is, but there you go.
Do I stand by it? Anyway, so Death Note is fascinating. It's free to watch, Graham. It's less than 2 hours. It will probably appall you 90, 80, 75% of the way through, but, well, appall is overstating it. But A, it's better than The Defenders, and B, it's very interesting to watch if you just have any sort of casual interest in like, the choices that are made, you can really see why people are making them, and it's not like they're making them in the, we don't have time, let's just get to the whiteboard. There was, like, a lot of thought put into it, but
yeah,
what
exactly.
That thought says...
They're very intentionally making them, but it's, doesn't that make them good decisions.
Exactly. So, you know, kind of worth watching. And again, you can watch it and be like, holy shit, Lakeith Stanfield. You know, when that guy gets his Oscar, you're gonna be like, oh yeah, I knew that was coming. So, but yeah.
I don't know, I've gotta say, you love the first season of Daredevil so much. Mm-hmm. The part of me is like, I'm gonna watch this and be like, eh, that guy's alright. And you're gonna be like, no, it's amazing.
It's true. I might.
You've shown up so much for the first season of Daredevil today that I'm like, I don't know if I can trust Jeff's opinion on anything.
Well, anymore. I'm not, I think the first season of Daredevil actually is not great. I mean, in terms of the way that it's written, like it starts strong, then it really loses its way. It's sort of depending on who you talk to, wins it back in the end or not. But I think that if you watch the first season of Daredevil, you can sit there and be like, okay, I feel, and maybe someone's willing to fist fight me on this because this has certainly happened before, like that, you know, that's a good actor. I think that person is better than their material. I think Charlie Cox is able to do much more as Matt Murdock than I would have thought. You know, sort of the same way that you, to me, I can watch Luke Cage and I'm like, yeah, the guy playing Luke Cage is good, but holy God, you know, Mahershala Ali is fucking incredible, you know? And I sort of feel like, I'm not saying that you're gonna watch, you know, I think, I would like to think that I can parse those things out, but who knows? Maybe not. Maybe my inability to tell a good TV show from a bad TV show means I can't tell a good actor from a bad actor.
All I'm saying is, you've been on pain medications this week.
I love
things
the idea.
Things may seem like somewhat out of whack. Which reminds me, Jeff.
Yes. Yes, Graham.
Starbrand?
Oh, yes. Starbrand. Holy
Because we have made it like an hour into this episode.
Yes.
Theoretically, our Starbrand special.
Yes.
We're not actually talking about Starbrand.
Well, and we should. I mean, I took such absurdly copious notes for my second read-through. Yeah.
Oh, my God. So I, first of all, because I know you did another read-through, and I want to ask, because I also read this like at least a month ago.
Right.
Which was when we were excited about it. And then this week was like, I have to reread it. And it felt like the worst thing in the world.
Yes. Well,
I so resented doing the reread before I did it.
Yeah.
Because I was just like, it's fun to read the shitty comics when you haven't read them for 20 years or 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's less fun when you've read them a month ago and you remember how bad they are.
Well, see, and yes, I absolutely agree. The first time a month ago when I read this stuff, I was like, oh my God. And it was right around the time you were doing yours and posting stuff on the Tumblr. I was like, yeah, we've got to do this. But if I was a younger man, enough of those details would have stuck. Because I think the thing that I find fascinating, and maybe you will flat out disagree, is Starbrand is such an impressive failure, and at multiple on multiple levels, and yet there's part of me that's kind of like, I think there's a little bit of, what is it that makes it so terrible? Because there's different, so many different flavors of terrible, and there's also sort of like, what's going on here? Why are some of the choices being made that they are? Like, the thing that I found really weird is when you get to the second volume of Starbrand, which is when John Byrne takes over, it seems very glib to be like, oh, and it's terrible because Byrne really doesn't care about Starbrand or the story. He literally just wants to character assassinate Jim Shooter via Mary Sue proxy for like a close to a dozen issues. And that seems like the glib take.
Like, but it's kind of true.
No,
all
it's totally true. It's totally
all
terrifying.
All
that issue
seems like, so Jim Shooter created Ken Connell, the lead character of his issues, very much in his image, like he's very much put a lot of into it. How can I really, really, really shit on Jim Shooter? I know. I'll make this guy insane. I'll make him nuke his hometown. I will then say he's a rapist. Then I will have him form a death cult.
Yeah. Yeah, and it just keeps going on and on.
Four issues time.
Yeah, yeah, no.
Like, it's fucking amazing.
Yeah, and the thing that I think is interesting to me, and the thing that's actually frustrating about it, is that it is, it's lazy and it's inaccurate. Like, when you read the stuff, one of the things that is interesting about Shooter Starbrand and what everyone is left to tussle with up until Byrne takes over is some really interesting, problematic, in some ways deliberately and in some ways unintentionally, problematic material with the character.
And, oh, shit, yes.
And what's fascinating is that Byrne doesn't have the patience or the interest or the ability or talent or whatever. I think mainly it's just interest. That it's just his, that he doesn't take the time to make his points work within the process of the story. Like,
oh no, but Byrne genuinely takes on Starbrand to shit on it.
Yes,
by two issues into Byrne's run, mm-hmm. he has literally killed off the entire cast with the exception of the lead character, and that is, three issues, because he does kill Duck
issues.
In the third issue.
Yep.
But also, he forgets Duck's name by the second issue.
Yeah.
Which is amazing!
Yeah, there's the weird...
Duck has an entirely different name by the second issue, and is never talked about.
Yeah. Well, sort of is. It sort of is. I mean, if you say never talked about. It depends on what your thing is. It depends on what your definition is. There's a weird point where everyone calls Deb the duck, Maddie, when she is pregnant and leaves Pittsburgh. And and at one point she says,
that's a name I haven't heard in a long time.
Right, and she says that Ken came up with my stage name. So there's some weird backstory there where the idea that she's Debbie Duck is actually her version of Joan Jett. I mean, there's a lot going on there. But I mean, I don't know if that's necessarily what you're talking about or there's some other emphasis, but there
No, that's exactly what I was talking about, because it sounds ridiculous. I don't believe that.
Mm-hmm. No,
the fact that literally it's never suggested during Shooter's run that her name is not
Deborah. Yeah.
to the point where she identifies herself mm-hmm. to Barb at one point by her full name.
Yes.
In the shooter run.
Yeah. Yep.
And then when Byrne comes along, he's like, no, she's actually called Maddie.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
And Deb is a nickname?
Yeah.
And it's like, what?
Yeah. It's like, it's weird. But there's weird.
The Byrne run is legitimately strange.
Yeah. There is
the shooter run is strange in a totally different way in that I genuinely believe Shooter was like, I am writing the next generation of superhero comic, but could not get out of his head enough.
Well,
and like it's a full of shooter weirdness on so many levels.
Let's stop putting the cart before the horse. Let's go back and let's talk about Starbrand Volume 1, which is Shooter's original run and the people who follow it.
Did you actually buy Volume? Because I bought Volume 2 during that Kindle sale.
Yeah, I got them both. Enormous sale. I was like, I've got to have both of these, you know. And then of course I was literally like, what have I done? What have I done?
Yeah, even for the probably $3 you spent, I think it was overpriced.
I don't know. I mean, the thing that's really crazy about it is,
One is everything, right? Volume 1 includes the annual, like the Bobby Chase annual.
Holy fuck, that's amazing, that shit.
Okay, let's go back to the shooter issues to begin with.
Yep.
Shooter's run lasts from issue 1 through issue 7. The issue 7, he only plots and Roy Thomas scripts.
Yes, that's right.
Because by that point, Shooter has been fired from Marvel.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
It was the lead book of the new universe,
mm-hmm.
Right up until issue 6, when all of a sudden it drops to bi-monthly while all the other books stick with monthly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's a deadline thing, if that's a Shooter being fired thing, whatever was happening.
Right.
But it never goes back to monthly after that. It stays bi-monthly, even though the other books are monthly.
Yeah.
It's Green Lantern.
Yes.
Like, it's unambiguously Green Lantern in mm-hmm. the first issue.
Yeah.
To the point where Ken Connell, the, let's be perfectly honest, to Jim Shooter stand-in,
mm-hmm.
is introduced as the Daredevil, by small d, character, who instead of a test pilot is a crazy biker.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's fearless as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets the weapon from the alien who is like, it's the most powerful weapon in the universe. You're getting it because you're fearless. But then there's an add-on, I want to say in the second or third issue, where the someone essentially says, being fearless is really bad. Being fearless is a sign of...
Yes.
They don't actually come out and say, like, mental illness, but they kind of do.
Yeah.
There's an implication that it is not healthy to be fearless.
It's actually later in the first issue. One of the things that is...
Really?
Yeah, it really is. It really is. Ken shows up to his buddy Myron's place, shows him that he can fly, and then recounts the whole story and saying things that he said keep coming back to me. And one of the things is he mentions that idea, you know, like Ken says, like, I said he should get a lion tamer, an astronaut, somebody fearless. And he said fearlessness is the absence of reason. One of the things I think is interesting is, on the one hand, like, part of me is like, okay, this is a smart way for Shooter to basically not have the entire issue be the scene between Connell and the old man. What unfortunately does is it begins the problem that just infests Starbrand like a plague, which is every time the story gets recapped, Shooter obsessively pokes new holes in it and also tries to semi-retcon things as he goes along. So that, honestly, like you said, like, he's only there for the first 6 or 7 issues, and by the time that he is done with it, the series has more or less dug itself into a trench of just tail-eating regression.
Like, it is amazing that by the time Shooter leaves at issue 7, 3 of those issues have been, I've gotten my powers from this alien, this alien is dead, this alien is not dead, this alien has come back and retconned the origin,
yep.
turned out to be a villain, died again, not died again,
Yep.
Come back from the dead a third time.
Yep.
And retcon the origin again in 7 issues.
Yep. The 6 issues in it, the threat, the, it is origin and alien, then terrorists in the 2nd issue, then spies in the 3rd issue, superpowered mental hospital escapees, then spies who are terrorists, and then it's back to the alien again. Like, it is such a tightly constricted little circle, again, because part of what Shooter is doing in Starbrand that I think really fucks him up is he's not constructing anything. He's deconstructing things in a way that gives him almost nowhere to go. Like, he
continually... Well, it's an astoundingly claustrophobic series, yes, even when Shooter is launching it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The series has essentially 5 characters. Mm-hmm. No, 6 characters, but one of them is the underage babysitter that Ken wants to fuck until he doesn't want to fuck her.
Right.
I mean, that plot literally goes nowhere and is one of those, a lot of the series actually is a lot of, Jim Shooter is clearly working through something.
Oh yeah.
And like uncomfortably so.
Yeah. Well, cause I think he's...
Especially because I then researched, I was reading up on the, like, ooh, the new universe, yada yada, uh-huh, and I found out that Debbie is actually based on one of Jim Shooter's ex-girlfriends.
Okay. That's amazing. What, did you find out anything else about that, or just sort of that simple statement?
No, just that. Apparently Myron and Debbie are both apparently based on people Shooter knew.
Which sort of makes sense, because like, the characters themselves...
in particular?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is like, considering, cause let's be honest, she's treated like shit throughout the entire book. By everyone.
Yes and no.
Apart from Roger and Roger's wife, whose name I've completely forgotten.
Well, okay, let's keep it split. Let's keep it split separate. If you don't mind, let's talk about volume one and volume two as two different things, you know? Yeah. So in the first volume, it's amazing how little stuff kind of makes sense, you know, but, and the stuff with Myron and Debbie Duck both feel sort of, because they seem to almost serve no purpose and they have a lot of texture, but that texture is really not put to any sort of story ends. You suspect that it's real life.
You buy that they're based on real people because they, it's not that they add anything to the series, because arguably they add the most to the series, but they don't serve any narrative purpose.
Exactly.
In a way that like Barb does, and Barb, yeah, by comparison, comes across as very fictional, very unreal.
Yeah.
Because she is purely there to honestly work out Shooter's issues. Like you don't think there's some like wacky shit going on with Shooter's relationship with women in general and Shooter's relationship with monogamy going on and being worked out?
No. I think Shooter has issues with women and I think Shooter's got huge issues with monogamy. But how do I put it? I'm not sure if the stuff with Deb is actually that with Barb is necessarily that fictional. Again, it just feels, it has less texture to it. So it's tempting to make it be like, oh, this is going to go to some genre stuff too. But no, what I thought was interesting was rereading this, the Shooter issues, how much, cause you've got separate situations where Ken gets together with friends who are characters that have never been mentioned before and aren't going to be mentioned again, really. And a lot of the reason for that is for those friends to basically say like, yeah, you know, basically you gotta fuck everything that you can. Like there's a point where...
Oh yeah, that's astounding. Is that issue 3 or 4? It might be 5, right?
Yeah, it's relatively in there.
Where Ken and Debbie go to hang out with the friends, mm-hmm, and the friend actually tells Ken outright, I like Debbie, she's a bimbo like my woman, but you should just cheat on her.
Yeah.
You seem stressed, why don't you just fuck strangers?
Yep. And he even says, that's what I do.
Yeah, the only thing we're really paraphrasing is,
the use of the word fuck.
Yeah.
Cause he does like outright say, you should hook up with strangers, which then comes to the hilarious Ken flies to a beach, meets a woman, and they fuck.
That's right. Yeah, that is. That's right. Like, yeah, this is later on.
And he's like, no, I have to leave. Yeah. But it's man, there is some wacky shit going on in these issues. And I want to know if you have the same opinion as me in this. That shit feels like what Shooter wanted to write about.
Mm-hmm.
And theoretically the A plots all feel like afterthoughts. Like it's terrorists, it's spies, it's like random people he ran into who have fear powers.
Right.
All seems like he's like, oh, but it's I've got to have punching.
Well, okay, he's but aware that it's just, right.
A neurotic man.
Right. Well, so that there's a lot of stuff that I feel that Shooter is addressing and redressing here. And as people know who've heard us talk, particularly during some of the stuff that was happening during the Avengers run and our talk, like Shooter sort of has kind of the I guess what I'd think of is reverse Gene Roddenberry syndrome or a variation on Gene Roddenberry syndrome. You know, Harlan Ellison said that Gene Roddenberry only had one plot, which is mankind goes into space, finds God, and God is an insane child, you know? And Jim Shooter is like, one plot is like, you give a dude ultimate power and they're going to want to bone with it, you know? And, I mean, it's perhaps not unsurprising that terrifying memo leaked that was Jim Shooter's notes about the sexuality of all the members of the Legion of Superheroes. You know, he has a belief that sexuality is like kind of an important driving force. And I think I've talked before about the little, you know, Shooter's sort of hidden, like, shut up nerds kind of concept. Like, Shooter had a lot of, neuroses. Like, I think he felt really incredibly insecure as a kid who grew up, like, poor in Pittsburgh, you know, more or less ended up writing comics very, very young, ended up having to swallow tremendous amounts of shit working under Mort Weisinger, as everyone who worked under Mort Weisinger did, but some people to lesser or greater willingness.
Well, I mean, he was doing it when he was 13 years old.
Well, see, there you go. So here's somebody who's 13 years old who starts writing in comics, you know, who I assume is not going to have is smart, and I'm assuming when they talk about Ken being self-educated, you know, Shooter mostly is as well. He has the chips and things that he has on his shoulder and the insecurities that he has, he makes up for with this idea that is not really any different from what most people at the Comics Journal were saying at the time, is that most of the other people writing for comics had no life experience really to speak of. They were just mimicking what they had read in comic books up to that point and were such big nerds. They had nothing else going on. It was all they knew was their book learning. Shooter, by contrast, had quote unquote lived, you know, and by living, he defined that as he dated, you know, he had sex with married women, he had sex with women who had kids, you know, he had sex with women who were, clearly like super needy, who thought that he was great or said that they were in love with him. And the extent to which Shooter was aware, like, of sort of the actual life experience of, I'm using this person, am I a good person, am I a bad person? And what's interesting about Starbrand is that he is trying to move beyond simple comic book morality of like, oh, Ken Connell's a good person, Ken Connell's a bad person. Like, Shooter's really like, I want to show that people are really just somewhere in between and kind of have to be, Because monogamy is an enormous lie, and any man given the chance will absolutely fuck anyone and everything. And once we can just all admit that and kind of get over our hang-ups, we'll be fine. And of course, you cut to the horrified group of people who are like, that's not all of human experience. And Shooter's like, no, it's okay. We're all friends here. We can talk about this. This really is the truth. Like, women are incredibly needy, and it makes sense for whatever reasons, and guys are just going to take advantage of that. And that's just the way the culture is. That's just the way society is. And people should stop saying, thinking of one another as good and bad, when really we're just trapped in a terrible situation that means that I will have as much vagina as I can get possibly in my life. And other people are going to judge me for that, you know? And it's kind of crazy. And the thing that I find kind of actually really strange and disappointing is when Byrne comes in and takes all of his cheap shots, and I won't stick on this long because it should be its own point, it's amazing how much one of the first things he has Myron say to Ken is like, you just use this power to get girls. And Ken's like, oh, no. Well, kind of. Well, not really. And the one of the things that Shooter goes out of his way to establish is the idea that Ken Connell is already, you know, knee-deep in vagina well before he gets superpowers. And that's kind of his point, is that the superpowers are really just an additional level of... They don't make you the way that comic book superheroes are defined by their powers being them. Like, Shooter does not believe that. There's a whole list of things that Shooter does not believe that comic books accurately represent. And in the course of deconstructing those things, he ends up essentially neutering any potential for drama. Because, of course, he's like, well, Ken Connell is not going to put himself out on a ledge and really risk revealing himself, and you're never going to get a situation where he runs into a supervillain by accident, because that never happens, except in that one issue with the mental hospital escapees where I'm going to have it happen, but it's kind of a one-time, you know, I'm going to point out that he's never going to see them again. Shooter basically is so eager to deconstruct all the rest of the superhero stuff. And that, to me, that's just important to him. What the Marvel superhero, more or less stands for him. He's like, yeah, that probably represented people's mores and beliefs and ideas and sexuality back in 1961 and 1963, in which our identity is tied to what we do. But he's like, but I want to show the world outside your window, which is basically that people do all kinds of things for all kinds of reasons if it involves having sex with other people. And the rest of it is all just additional levels of headache that don't necessarily define you. But when you have a superhero comic in which your main character is not defined by being a superhero, you're left with nothing. And it's amazing that Shooter really was going to thought that this is going to be the flagship of a universe that is totally going to redefine the nature of superhero comics. And it's like, when it's just, well, anyway, I feel like I'm talking and you're probably sitting there reading the comics being like, I remember when I had good points. I wish I hadn't let him talk about Death Note. I'm never going to get a chance to say my good points now, so.
Well, no, I part of me wants to interrupt you because I think you're reading more into Byrne's criticism of Shooter's fascination with sexuality than is actually there.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Myron getting the girl part in issue 11, is like the parting cheap shot, is intended as a parting cheap shot, and what Ken is responding to is the other stuff that Myron is saying, which is much more an attack on Shooter self-image in terms of you surround yourself by weaker, needier people, and you play down your own skills because you want people to compliment you.
Mm-hmm. Which
and that right. rang like it, that rang rings much more maybe not true but important to me mm-hmm. than the girl part. Mm. And so it was interesting to me, like I literally looked back and I was like, I don't even really remember the getting the girl part. And I was looking back and looking at the page and being like, yeah, I think you're right about Shooter's focus on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in a weird way, I think that's all subconscious on Shooter's part. I think Shooter really does genuinely believe he is like updating the Marvel formula and making these relatable people because Ken Connell is him.
Right.
But at the same time, it just shows Shooter's, how unique Shooter is,
mm-hmm.
which is probably not true, but the Shooter is a very particular worldview. Mm-hmm. And the Shooter worldview is far more self-censored and mm-hmm. far centered as opposed to censored, which is what it sounded like, and far more egotistical
mm-hmm.
and I think he was aware he was.
Oh.
Because.
Graham, do you mind repeating? You suddenly dropped out for like just 2 seconds there. Sorry. Like literally just okay. when you got to your noun. So what was that?
I was saying that Ken Connell is far more self-centered and far more egotistical than I think Shooter realized he was making him.
Mm-hmm.
Because. As you said, Shooter drops out the traditional superhero elements of Starbrand.
Mm-hmm.
And is like, look, this is a realistic guy. But what you're left with is this amazing sort of like proto-slacker
mm-hmm.
who exists to question whether he's reached his full potential
mm-hmm.
while everyone around him is telling him that he's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And every now and again he's like, oh, I should probably try... Oh, what if I go and take care of these terrorists? Ugh, that was no fun.
Right.
You know, and you're like, Ken Connell is an astoundingly A, passive, and B, unlikable lead character in the Shooter run.
Yeah, he, like, right, yes.
Basically so. Mm-hmm. And what's fascinating to me is when you get to the immediate post-Shooter issues, mm-hmm. and you have Carrie Bates and Bobby Chase writing.
Right.
How they deal with Shooter's version of Ken Connell. Because Byrne pretty much like keeps him around to insult him.
Yeah.
But Bates and Chase actually try and treat him as a character.
Oh yeah.
And their version of him
mm-hmm.
is fascinatingly sociopathic.
Actually, you know, the thing that it's funny that you mention that because the Chase issue is fucking phenomenal in the way that it is. Ken is a brash young man to the point of being a sociopath, but interestingly enough, in a kind of there's a way in which Chase's story makes sense within
because
a certain
everyone is a sociopath.
Well, yeah, exactly. In a certain framework, which is to say that by crafting the Starbrand annual is very much in the vein of the sort of direct-to-video erotic thrillers, or even just sort of some of the erotic thrillers, it's much closer to be like being an identifiable thing, and that identifiable thing is kind of like you see represented in bad movies, but also has a kind of consistent worldview, which is essentially that everyone is terrible and mistaken, and which I think is really helpful in the sense of the Starbrand annual. No one makes it out of the Starbrand annual unscarred. In fact, spoilers, Ken Connell's the only one who makes it out alive.
You know.
But at this stage of it, every character, from the insane boyfriend to the French woman who Ken falls in love with, like at every stage they are both inherently wrong and right, I guess, about things. They're never right about the things that they think they're right about, but they more or less end up creating a world or a universe in which they prove their worst suspicions right about the world. And I think that's really fascinating as a way to interpret both Star Brand and sort of Shooter's, what Shooter's doing in a way that is more layered and more interesting than what Burns' critique ends up being. I do want
to. Yeah, well, no, exactly. There's a lot more to, as weirdly cartoonish as Chase's Annual is.
Yes.
She at least addresses Shooter's version of Connell.
Mm-hmm.
She does so, and also can only make him seem heroic by surrounding him by worse people. Like, no, but Ken's quote unquote friend who flies him to, is it fucking Switzerland?
Yes.
Flies him to Switzerland seemingly with the only reason that he should seduce the friend's girlfriend to prove that the girlfriend is unfaithful.
Yeah.
And then when it looks like it might happen, hires assassins to kill both of them.
Yeah.
Is astounding.
Yeah.
But Connell feels consistent with what Shooter was writing in a way that, like, Burns doesn't.
Yes.
You know, of that matter, exactly. Carrie Bates doesn't. Carrie Bates, I feel, in his three issues, is trying to write a more traditionally superhero version.
Well, and I have to say, I've got to parse out some differences in just a second, but I do want to say, one of the things that's interesting for me about the 20 years from when I read most of these Star Brand comics, not all of them, and when I revisited them, is since then, having read, I didn't think much of Carrie Bates back in the day. I was like, he's fine as a generic DC guy working in the generic DC stuff. That was before I read Trial of the Flash. As you know, I'm a huge fan of some of the stuff that he was doing in The Flash with Barry Allen and Barry Allen's midlife crisis and all the other stuff leading up to the trial. So when I saw him,
and he was also around this time doing Video Jack for Epic. Do you remember Video Jack?
Oh, I know it was out in the world. I never read it.
Weird. Like it's very much of the, and I want to say it was like 86, 87, but it feels very much like Bates, who was in many respects like a journeyman writer, but it feels like he had watched Max Headroom. And was then like, me and Keith Giffen are going to make this really fucking surreal series.
Right.
Like, I've just read American Flag. I've just watched Max Headroom. I'm on it. And it's a really weird, unusual, not what you expect from Carrie Bates series. Which kind of makes me wish he'd done more Star Brand.
Well.
Because he had some wackiness in him.
He does. I mean, you look at the Trial of the Flash stuff or some of the other stuff he was doing with Barry Allen. The reason why I got really excited as shit when I saw Carrie Bates' name on there, because I was like, oh crap, Bates might be the perfect choice for Star Brand because he also has some ideas in with Barry Allen's Flash about using the superhero split as a way to look at male insecurity, I guess, that I thought that would fit potentially very well in with Shooter's Star Brand stuff, potentially. And I want to mention one of the things that's interesting is, as you know, the second of the two Star Brand issues that Bates does, he does do with Keith Giffen. And it's their Nightmask Kirby issue, which I didn't think came off especially well, but it was interesting to see that they,
An interesting failure, but it's also very traditionally, it's the most traditional of the issues, I think.
Yes. It is to both in a way, sort of to its detriment in a way that, the previous issue before had a certain, like it, fit in with Shooter's rules. There was another thing I wanted to mention about Shooter's run, which actually, but before I get to that, I want to actually mention, you have conflated Carrie Bates with George Caragone. George Caragone.
Oh, I have. You're totally right.
Which
Caragone does issue 10?
10.
Bates is 8 and 9 and Caragone does issue 10, right?
Yeah. And Caragone is interesting because of course I was like, who the fuck is George Caragone? And you probably are better at tracking this than I did, but Caragone was the guy who actually ended up being the co-founder of Penthouse Comics, and he actually committed suicide in 95 before his 30th birthday, which is, to me, just like reading Karagonia, cause I was like, oh, Karagonia and Mark Bagley. I was going to be like, who are these guys, Graham? But I really was like, I don't know who George Karagonia is. I mean, you know, the Bagley thing was sarcastic. And reading his Wikipedia entry is like one of the saddest things ever. Cause Karagonia, killed himself before he was 30, created Penthouse Comics. But before he did that, he was, had been an animator who more or less went, like, wrote comics, ended up writing a bunch of comics for the Star Comics line, ended up doing Star Brand at issue 10, follows Shooter to the Valiant universe, and basically when he hears Shooter's doing it, drives all the way to New York and apparently walks in and offers his services, and ends up writing like licensed comics for Valiant. Like, he really doesn't have, he's got this this terrifying life of someone who like tried to follow Jim Shooter and get in close with Jim Shooter as a way of building his career, and then just ends up in a weird Funhouse Mirror version of Jim Shooter founding pornographic comics and then being fired and then literally leaping to his death in a way that of course Shooter did not. But it's really, I just wanted to mention it because it's one of those things of like, oh, holy shit, like, that's a little footnote that's way more sad and depressing than I would have, like, wow, something more depressing than the Star Brand stories. That's remarkable. Yeah, Bates had, I had that moment with Bates where I'm like, oh, if he had kept doing it, maybe he could have gotten somewhere interesting with Star Brand. Oh, right, which is the other thing is that Graham, I feel that the Shooter Star Brand comics are paced really weirdly. I also feel like they're paced more like TV than comics. Did you get that feeling? Like, the first issue in particular has the sort of...
The first issue is paced astoundingly strangely to the point where you do wonder whether this story has been cut up.
Yeah. But all of the rest of the stuff, like, it's very common as you know and I know, the Marvel formula of basically, like, you know, open with a dramatic action scene, get in some talking, close with a dramatic action scene, kind of, you know, 2-1-2 kind of deal. Shooter is doing a lot of gabbing, and then the action comes in and is usually quick, and reminded me in a lot of ways, weirdly, of the Incredible Hulk TV show. Like, not in any way in the sense of, like, you know, there's, like, bad special effects there, but I was surprised by how much of it... Shooter is keeping really minimal. He's keeping super heavy on the relationships. And even when the power stuff breaks out, sometimes it's super big. But in the stuff with the terrorists and the spies, it's literally like, I'm flying and I'm getting lost. In fact, and this is really weird, is how much Star Brand kind of resembles Green Lantern, but also The Greatest American Hero. Like, do you remember that TV show?
I've never seen the show.
So
I know it exists. I know what it is.
Yeah, you know what it is. So
they didn't have a show called The Greatest American Hero in a country that wasn't America.
That is shocking to me because
just put that out there.
It's
here's the thing. They probably did.
I'm sure they did.
No, but what I think is responsible for that is I think Shooter is very much trying to keep to the quote unquote rules of the new universe, which was new universe was supposed to take place in real time.
Right.
So that, like, by the end of a year would have passed.
Yes.
And also, that nothing so big would happen that it would break the quote-unquote reality of the universe.
Right. Yeah. There couldn't be anything that didn't happen outside the real world, so to speak.
Right? So you have, like, you have a nuclear explosion, but it's a nuclear explosion that happens at the very bottom of the ocean.
Yeah.
And it's essentially deafened by Starbrand. And you know, you have, he attacks the terrorists later after, you know, they kind of piss him off, but it's sort of hushed up, and it's reported in the news like, whoa, things happened, who knows,
right?
And the mechanics of that mean that you can't have the traditional superhero fight aspect. You know, you've got to have something smaller, and I think Shooter was, as the guy who came up with this rule, maybe the only person in the new universe who actually believed it.
Yeah.
I actually also read the first issues of Spitfire and the Troubleshooters. Inspired by this, loosely, by this. And it's amazing how quickly that book just like careens off into like bad Iron Man. I'm going to say it quickly. I mean like by issue two.
Oh yeah. Well, as you know, because Star Brand pops up in issue five, they reprinted in volume one here, and issue five of Star Brand and Spitfire and the Troubleshooters, written by Jerry Conway and Roy Thomas, is yeah, clearly you've got like a machine rampaging down the streets in Boston with like an overheating power pack kind of thing. And it's like, okay, that's clearly a game changer. And, but to be fair, honestly, it's also in its completely sort of hackneyed way.
Like, it's more interesting than Starbrand.
It's more interesting than Starbrand. One of the things that's fascinating to me is, yeah, Shooter removes all these, puts in all these little rules in place and doesn't realize the extent, or doesn't care the extent to which it checkmates the ability to get a story that can progress some way.
Oh, I know. I think he is perfectly aware of what it does to the story. Mm-hmm. But I think he is also very much of the mindset of, the only way to get to the quote unquote future of comics is to make sure that we can't write the same stories again. I think the part that he's missing is you have to have something to replace it.
Exactly. And he doesn't. He really doesn't.
Just,
yeah.
For his seven issues, he just repeatedly demonstrates that he has nothing to replace it, to the point where when the old man comes back and he's like, I'm an alien and I, you know, we're going to have a fight that will eventually go into fucking space.
Yep.
That is the most memorable part of Shooter's run.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is breaking his own rules.
Yep.
But it's giving there actually is conflict in these stories.
Mm-hmm.
Because without it, there is soap opera that is just illustrating Shooter's own relationship hang-ups.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the sexual hang-ups, because Myron is very particular. You know, Myron is there to glorify Ken, but also to show the ways in which Ken has reason not to trust other men.
Right. Actually, that's a good point. I mean, the Myron stuff, again, is something that's weird, because I really had that thing of like, either Shooter has never been to therapy and just read some decent, you know, some half interested, read some descriptions of it, or he knew someone that was like a completely, utterly unethical therapist. And the idea that Myron was based on a real person, because you've got situations where therapy sessions are happening, but they're not, or there's that classic, like he invites Ken into a group therapy session and is like, oh, it's okay, you know most of these people.
And he then weaponizes that therapy session against Ken.
Exactly, exactly.
There's also, Myron is living with one of his patients.
Exactly. His patients who he's making work for the room and board and therapy. And it's a woman who is like bringing in the groceries. Everything about it is like, this is unethical.
But Myron is the, I'm trying to think of a good way of saying this without like, you know, delving into like, uncomfortable cliches, but if Ken is the alpha male,
mm-hmm.
then Myron is the beta male, and he is showing how untrustworthy he is, how I don't want to say immoral, because I think that Ken also comes across as very immoral,
mm-hmm.
but Myron is immoral in a very particular way, very untrustworthy,
right.
Very selfish and weak, and selfish because he's weak.
Well,
I'm trying to manipulate Ken, and therefore illustrating Ken's superiority as a result.
But yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I'm tempted to say that he exists. I mean, I think the idea that he exists is a reason for Ken to not trust men. Although you see Ken have other relationships that are not with his coworkers or his boss, for example, that are in no way especially fraught. I think the thing that's interesting about Myron is the idea that Myron is untrustworthy and amoral And that's the thing. When you say immoral, I think this is, I think Shooter's ultimate contribution is the idea that essentially he, I think Shooter himself, there's a very good case to be made, is an amoral person and is aware of the importance of moral posturing, but it ultimately does not believe it. Ken doesn't believe it. Myron doesn't believe it, that morality actually exists or is anything other than something that you pay lip service to. And most of what people do in the world is either to get what they want or to keep what they have. That's not necessarily an uninteresting place to go with any sort of comic or any sort of drama, though it's just his inability to dramatize it is the part that's really kind of a shame, you know?
Well, also, like, how conscious do you think this is in Shooter's part? Part of me thinks that Shooter is such a bad writer that if he was actually trying to intentionally do that, he would do it in a much more obvious and less subtle way.
I have a little more faith in Shooter, actually, weirdly enough. I mean, one of the things that, as someone chided us way back when, and I don't think it was Dan Coyle who goaded us into doing this, or goaded is the wrong word, actually.
But we should also completely give Dan credit, because I said in the back of the building, I don't remember why we're doing Starbound. It's totally Dan's fault. He did suggest that we thought it was a good idea.
Exactly.
Sorry,
Dan. I did want to make sure that Dan got credit, but he may well have been the person, because at one point when, before I reread the issues, we were talking about the idea that Debbie was more or less mentally disabled and more or less having sex with Ken. And people were like, she's not mentally disabled. And, some of the writing is very, very bad and it's kind of iffy, but here's right. Debbie has terrible self-esteem, but one of the things that is interesting about the scope of the six or seven issues that is quote unquote subtle is the idea in which Ken is more or less in love with Debbie and talks about the fact, basically reoccurrently refers to her as the best person and defends her at several points where people are like, hey, she's just a bimbo. And he's like, I think she's the best person I've ever known, you know? And I think the idea that Shooter was trying to build toward something that was like a romance there, or that would have made, like, Ken would have ended up making that sort of moral decision that's really, you know, the sort of thing that you see in any romantic movie kind of deal.
Well, he kind of gets there, because by the end of Shooter's run,
right,
Barb is out of the picture.
Yeah.
Barb then immediately reappears because of Hey Fillin issues.
Yeah.
But Barb has kicked Ken out, and Ken ends up with Debbie at the end of Shooter's run.
That's right.
Yeah. And is arguably happier.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because of that.
Exactly. Exactly. Which again is one of those things that is kind of especially churlish about Byrne when he comes in, is he makes it a point to knock those blocks out, you know.
But everything about the Byrne run is churlish. I mean, really seriously.
Yeah.
Should we just go on to the Byrne issues?
I think we should. I think we've sort of talked about we've talked about the Shooter stuff as thoroughly as we should. We should move on to the Byrne stuff. Because holy shit, the Byrne stuff is horrible. I mean, and it really is.
It's genuinely breathtaking how much the first couple of issues in particular, which is the lead up to him blowing up Pittsburgh, lead up to Ken Connell blowing up Pittsburgh, feels spiteful.
Yeah. So spiteful.
Like genuinely spiteful towards not only Shooter, but everything that has happened before in the comic.
Mm-hmm.
And don't get me wrong, I think you and I have made it clear that we don't particularly like the previous issues of the comic, and that it's filled with flaws.
Mm-hmm.
But Shooter seems to be angry at those issues of the comic.
You mean Byrne? It's going to be this is going
sorry,
to happen.
Yeah, Byrne, sorry, yeah, sorry, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Byrne seems angry at the earlier issues of the comic, and determined to rub everyone's noses in it for reading them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And just being like, these are stupid, these are dumb, these, like, just everything about this is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And those two issues are just really weirdly mean.
Oh yeah.
And well, also set up, they also set up something that recurs through the entire thing, which is there's that entire subplot for two issues of the guy who's like, I know who Starbrand is.
Right.
I know him. Like, and I'm with my mistress who I left my wife for.
Yeah.
And I hate her. Right. And then, like, in the second issue, they get blown up and it never goes anywhere.
Oh, because it's
like, it's super weird.
It's a red herring though. I mean, everything.
No, that's it. Like, so much of this is so much of Burns Run is a red herring.
Yeah.
So much of Burns Run is, you think this? Nope. You think this? Nope. Yeah. And there's nothing to it beyond the nope.
Right. Well, see, that's it. It is its own form of deconstructing the deconstructing. Like, no, you're wrong. And having really no interest in going very far, much further than that. That, and honestly, the desire to make Ken Connell more like Jim Shooter so that Byrne can have the pleasure of punching of burning him in effigy. No pun intended.
Oh God. And he really does.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As if the idea that Ken blows up Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
In issue 12 isn't enough.
Yeah.
When you next see him in issue 14, it is revealed that he's gone insane.
Yeah.
But in going insane, he has kidnapped a woman and has been raping her for days.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you.
Which genuinely the part where I'm like, there's like that, oh, somehow that steps over a line. And I don't know why that in particular stepped over a line for me, but I was like, oh, you really hate this guy.
Yeah, you really hate this guy. What I've wondered about on that front, actually, Graham, and I didn't have the time to research this, but I am 90%, well, 90. I'm 60% sure that the scene.
I'm 30% sure.
Yeah, I'm much less sure. Yeah, exactly. I will be down to like 2% sure by the end of this sentence. That sequence is a specific shout out to a shooter sequence with Graviton in the Avengers, or it's some other shooter story. But isn't it Graviton is the dude who, like, I get all this amazing power and he becomes obsessed with the woman in the office who it doesn't really love him, but he's basically like, I've got the ultimate power and you're going to be with me now, and more or less coerces her. And they're
I genuinely don't know, but at the same time, almost all shooter stories about someone getting the ultimate power include the woman who, they want, but does not want them back.
Right.
Like that's a recurring theme.
That's exactly. And this is, but I feel like there was something very specific where she does not want him, but she ends up capitulating to him because he is the, you know, sort of the alpha male. And
yeah.
I want to say she maybe even betrays him to free the Avengers or something like that. I don't really remember.
It might not be Graviton. For some reason, I'm thinking of the Korvac saga, but I could be wrong.
The Korvac stuff is a little bit different because he is, but that's actually Korvac is different because the woman that he's with, who's like the plant from, I forget who, is supposed to betray him, but she's so in love with him that she doesn't. So it's the two of them. He's so amazing with his sex that she betrays the universe for him. But I feel like this particular sequence, right down to the idea of her hanging suspended in air and begging him, is a very specific shout out to a shooter sequence. But I could be wrong. But it is also on its own, like, weirdly vile. And except at each issue, like, it's almost as if years before South Park, Byrne was like, I'm going to turn Ken Connell into Kenny.
From South Park.
Yeah,
yeah.
Who dies in at the end.
Because he kills him repeatedly to the point where at one point when Ken dies, he actually says, oh no, not again.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But he does. He kills him 3 or 4 times.
Yeah, yeah.
And exactly. Burn Run is 9 issues long.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So at some point,
so he really is dying like every couple of issues.
Yeah, exactly. And he also has him be convinced that he's the Messiah.
Can we also talk about the fact that when Byrne is killing him off every couple of issues, that in itself is playing on a shooter trope? Because shooters killed the old man off like 4 times.
Well, yeah.
In the run of his issues.
Yes.
And for Burton's eventual retcon in the final issue.
Yeah.
Like that kind of like it's almost like he was doing foreshadowing, even though I fully believe that the final issue is Byrne pulling it out of his ass at the last moment.
Yeah. I mean, the thing...
I don't think he's heading towards the reveal that he has in that final issue at all. Until maybe the issue before.
What I find fascinating about the Starbrand comic, the Volume 2 stuff, which includes the Pit in its entirety and then goes back to the Starbrand material, is essentially just how bad and half-assed it is. Like, these are bad John Byrne comics. Like, there are points that make no sense. It annoys me when he takes stuff that and contradicts stuff that's explicitly stated in the shooter run. But then you see points where Byrne is just contradicting himself. And let's face it, the whole Pit storyline is just impressively awful. Like, it's all half-assed. Like, they thought none of it through. And
it's kind of amazing. Mm-hmm. The Pit special.
Yeah.
They're spending the entire 48 pages going, this is really important, you guys. Yeah. This is a game changer. Nothing will ever be the same.
Yeah.
And then go on to do nothing with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, and I think
it's... And not even in the sense of like, well, there's nothing that really follows up on it in the Byrne issues of Starbrand, because there kind of is.
You
can get like, you know, kind of a bit with it. But I remember, this is my secret shame, Jeff. There was a point in the late 90s, no, mid 90s, where I discovered a secondhand bookstore. That had a shit ton of Marvel books from the 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Or cheap, cheap, cheap.
Mm-hmm.
So when I say that I have read possibly every single New Universe comic after The Pit, with the exception of The Draft and The War, the two miniseries that ended it, I'm not exaggerating.
Right.
And when I tell you that The Pit is honestly a narrative that no one really dared pick up again afterwards...
Mm.
Mm-hmm. I'm not exaggerating.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm fascinated by, there's a whole bunch of stuff that's put into place. Like, essentially they're like, okay, we're gonna take the new universe and we're gonna turn it into the world's biggest, messiest Stephen King novel. And then they chicken out on it, which is fascinating to me. Like, just the fact, just reading volume 2 of Starbrand, where one of the most crucial points to the whole Pit storyline is the idea of, like, is there life after death? And is there some sort of, do people mystically continue the way that the Witness does and what he glimpses in the Pit or not? It's a huge, crucial, like, everything that happens in the Pit is supposed to be the suggestion that yes, there is, and yet in just about every single issue of Starbrand, Byrne makes it a point of saying, no, there's not. Like, there's the whole point of the Starbrand baby, destroys Debbie, like, kills her, and then afterwards presents himself as like, oh, I integrated her consciousness and it's part of mine. And Jane is like, prove it. And he's like, oh, I can't. I lied. You know? And at every single stage, it's possible that one could, like, if one wanted to be like, oh, it really kind of all means something. It's possible to say that in the course of the various agendas that are happening within Shooter's run and then Byrne's run shitting on Shooter, while they're so busy running that stuff and filling the pages with the stuff that they're not paying attention to, you could arguably say that what is happening in the Starbrand issues, including the Pit and stuff, is that there is a to steal a point from Carter Schultz writing in the Comics Journal about a different set of books, a fear of life that is disguised as a fear of death. That there is this idea that keeps coming back in Burns Run that at what happens after we die is this thing. And he says it powers all these religions. And you see Ken Connell set himself up as a messiah. And on the one hand, that's clearly, you know, kicking Shooter's messiah complex in the balls. But the whole idea that the superhero fantasy is a fantasy, not so much about justice, but about immortality, and that immortality ends up being this crucial idea in the Burn Run, to the point where in order to tie off the story, it becomes this time travel Ouroboros loop where Ken and the old man and everyone who has the Star Brand are basically the same person, and they can never die, that the Star Brand is itself a circle. Is this way?
Except it's not, because he cheats his own point.
Exactly. It cheats it badly in order to make it work, where you're like, that makes no sense, you know.
To get back to your thing about immortality, don't forget that there is a 2-issue period where the Starbrand baby has removed death, yes, has undone death.
Yeah, right.
And that's not even investigated.
No,
like,
right.
Weird things happen. Star Brand Baby shows up and it's like, I got rid of death, and you guys, it was really hard. It took me a few weeks. And then Roger's wife, and I wish I could remember her name for the life of me.
Isn't it just Jane?
Says,
Roger and Jane, I think.
Sure, okay. Okay, why maybe not? I honestly can't remember. but she says, oh, that's really bad. And he's like, is it? Oh, I'm a dummy. Death's back.
Right.
And that's it.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. It's, Burn is so, half-assing this comic.
Yeah.
That he's like, I've got this grand concept that I'm literally going to do nothing with.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That I will announce and undo within pages. And he does that continuously.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the Starbrand baby goes, you are an old dude. I will give you the power because as an old dude, you will do something different with the power. Yeah. And all you get is like this random guy being like, well, gosh, shucks, darn.
Yeah.
I guess I should do something good. I'm an old dude after all. Gosh, shucks, darn.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah. It's
like
so
Burn does nothing with the idea of maybe this guy would do something different with absolute power.
Right. No, it's at every stage.
Zero interest in exploring any of his own concepts, which is kind of makes sense given like the Pit is introduced and then it's like, hey you guys, Pittsburgh is a radioactive thing, but only joking, it's not actually radioactive. It's just this big hole in the ground that apparently is going to destabilize the Earth. Only joking. No, it's not. But there's going to be monsters. Only joking. We only told you about the monsters just 5 pages before we killed them off.
Yep.
Oh.
Yep.
It's astounding how many things Burn is like, you guys, here's an idea, only joking, here's an idea, only joking,
exactly,
here's an idea, continually throughout his run.
Yeah, no, there is so much of it that is like, oh, we're going to just throw all these mad ideas at the wall, and there is no interest in developing. In fact, one of the things I was going to say is you sort of wonder the extent to which, again, unconsciously, Burn is sort of equating death with comic book hack work. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like comic book cliches. They're like death. Nobody wants them, but if you get rid of them, nothing works anymore. You know? Like, it's...
And prove it. Here's lots of cliches. Nothing working.
Yeah, and also nothing working. Well, it is true. I'm fascinated the extent to which... I know that you're not a fan of the material, and there are people who are not, but honestly... Anyone to me who complains about Alan Moore's Miracle Man material should have to read Star Brand Volume 2. Because...
Oh, it's astounding. Mm-hmm. Like, it genuinely is. You have... And Miracle Man is not my favorite comic, but Alan Moore is trying to do things and it's actually wrestling with ideas. Yep. And Star Brand is John Byrne thinking he's doing things and wrestling with absolutely zero ideas.
It really, really... Really impressive. Man, these were so terrible. And like I said, there's also just a weird, anyway, Graham, I cannot tell you how terrible these were on a reread. They were fun in a so bad it's good kind of way, but for people who are wondering, like, what's the radioactive half-life on a shitty ass comic? before you read it again and get some of that, oh, I'm wasting my life. It's definitely longer than a month. I will tell you that. Your grandma and I.
Well, no, that's very true because I'm so glad you had the same reaction that I did. Mm-hmm. The, I'm glad I read this a month ago and then just a feeling of dread.
Yeah.
And knowing that we're about, that I was about to do it again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Really just a, I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
This is a great idea back before I realized I'd have to do it.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well, it does. I mean, again, maybe if I had taken copious notes when I first read it, but yeah, I, oh my God. It's, oh, I actually may try and clean up these notes that I did write and then post them so people can see just how absurdly I overprepared. And also just how clearly this stuff broke my brain and I'm suffering. So I don't know. We'll see. But that's our special Star Brand episode. Thank God.
Half of which was about Defenders.
Well, you know, honestly, Graham, we can still talk about it some more, man. I tell you, if you got more.
It's not about Star Brand, but it's about the new universe in general. Like I said, I did reread Spitfire.
Right.
Spitfire and the Troubleshooters.
Right.
And, you know, you and I both said it's much more quote unquote traditionally superheroic. And also because of that, better.
Yes.
What is fascinating to me is the speed at which that comic goes through story.
Mm-hmm.
Where it is by issue 5, the issue that's repeated in the reprinted in volume 1 of Starbrand.
Oh yeah.
Should be like 2 years down the line.
Mm-hmm.
It's so fast that the first issue sets up the dynamic, theoretically the dynamic of the series,
mm-hmm.
which is, Spitfire is Jenny Swanson. Her dad is an inventor. He essentially invents an Iron Man suit. He is murdered by his boss.
Mm-hmm.
She realizes this. She basically gets a message from her dad, and because it's like 1986, it's like, I've logged into this computer bulletin board that only we know about because we are geniuses.
Right.
He's left me a message, yada yada. But the issue ends with Jenny and her, who is a teacher at MIT, and her students, the Troubleshooters, going on the run.
Mm-hmm.
Because this dude is going to chase after them. They've stolen the Iron Man armor. And he is going to chase after them. That's the story.
Mm-hmm.
They're on the run with this armor. They're going to try and do good, but also work out how to expose him as a murderer.
Right.
Issue two, Jeff, ends with her saying, "It's gone on too long. It all ends here." Issue two. By issue four, that dude. It's issue five, the issue that's reprinted in.
Yes.
Okay, so by the end of issue four, that dude is dead.
Yep.
He's been murdered by a secret organization who has hired an international assassin.
Yeah.
Which is where the series goes finessing. But not only that, these Troubleshooters, who are all MIT students,
mm-hmm.
have retro-engineered their own Iron Man-esque armor. Issue 5.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's astounding how quickly it goes through.
Yeah.
And by issue 9, the Troubleshooters are fucking dead, Jeff.
Oh, Jesus. Well, of course. Well, but at least you're getting some story. Like, by contrast.
But you're getting too much story. You genuinely are getting too much. Because the funny thing is, you have this uber plot that's moving super quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But on an issue by issue basis, you also have this Starbrand issue.
Mm-hmm.
By which I mean like subject, topic, problem. Because you have that nothing really happens.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Like the uber plot advances super quickly, right. Kind of behind the scenes.
Mm.
Whereas like the biggest thing that happens in issue 2 is Spitfire rescues dudes who are about to drive their truck off a cliff. And then there's a tank that she wrestles with.
Right.
And do you know how she defeats the tank, which is my favorite thing? Because it's before Wi-Fi. She literally cuts the telephone cable that is remote controlling the tank.
Ah, nice.
Cause of course.
Cause of course.
But you know, so you have the simultaneous, like the Uber plot is going very fast. I mean, far too fast.
Mm-hmm.
But each individual issue is really badly written soap opera.
Right.
And incredibly underwhelming, like, issue by issue villains and, right. and danger.
Well, you know, that's interesting is that I have fond memories of Grunwald's DP7. And which is interesting because when they cross over in Starbrand here, it's unsurprisingly terrible. But
also that's during the Byrne era.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, Byrne is, that's the other thing in his Starbrand. You realize just how amazingly ungenerous Byrne is as a creator.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That he's going to tell the story he wants to tell and he'll use other people's characters, but he never, he's entirely reductive when he does so. He never really creates anything new to play with.
Mm-hmm.
He really will just like use someone else's character and be like, I'm done with him. Like the DP7 guest shot essentially ends the plot of DP7.
Well, yeah. And I sort of assumed that was with Grunwald's blessing but I don't know. Yeah. I mean, cause in theory,
DP7 was still going on at that time.
Well, I wasn't tracking it, but I'm in that sense. Like, believe me, the stuff that I remember fondly is kind of in that first year lead up to the pit. And then at that point, I think I even read a couple of post-pit issues of DP7 because it was like, oh, yeah, I kind of care about these characters and then forget it. But, like, other stuff that I read that I'm pretty sure would not hold up because it didn't at the time, like Justice, as you and I talked about, or, like, Mark Hazard Merc, which was over within a year, and, again, character was dead, I think.
And also, yeah, they killed Mark Hazard before Merc ended.
Oh, right, because then his no, I'm getting it confused with Justice, where his daughter comes in or something, but yeah.
No, Justice, no, Mark Hazard is replaced, maybe not by his daughter, but he's replaced by someone. Justice, they just completely redo the entire high concept.
Yeah.
Like, a year in. Yeah. Like, utterly. They're like, everything you knew was literally a lie, this guy just had a psychotic break, and here's the real story.
I'm fascinated by how much of the material, like the behind the scenes material that they pack into Starbrand Volume 1 to kind of up the page count. Lots of Marvel Age articles and things, which, you know, for
same
those of us who are not,
too.
Yeah, right, for, right, exactly. For those of us who are not Graham McMillan and furtively collecting Marvel Age issues on the sly, it was kind of fascinating to read the stuff. I was shocked by how much Archie Goodwin had to do, like, he created, like, 4 of the 7 titles, is the way that he made it sound, which I'm just like...
Yeah. And do they have the design? Because, like, Walt Simonson designs Cyphers.
Oh, wow. Interesting. Yeah, so, I mean, again, there's kind of that thing of, like, Archie Goodwin ideas, like, some of this should have worked somehow, some of this should have stuck, but
none of it did. The other thing is, it is inevitably not in the Marvel Age stuff. But you know, Kickers Incorporated was one of the launch titles, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Kickers Incorporated.
You know, the Kickers Incorporated was like a last minute rewrite because of Shooter's Rules of the New Universe, and it was originally an entirely different book.
Oh no, really?
Like entirely different to the point where it had a different title.
Wow.
Because it was Tom DeFalco and Ron Frenz who created it. And it was essentially going to be Challengers of the Unknown.
Wow.
And then Shooter was like, no, we don't have anything that fantastic. You know, make it much more realistic. Make it about football guys, like football players. but no, so I was researching, you know, New Universe stuff today, and according to a story I read, and I don't know how true this is, and I'd love to know how true this is. Mm-hmm. Apparently, one of the original titles thought up for the New Universe was Strike Force Morituri.
Ah, interesting.
Which is very strange, right? Mm-hmm. Because I can't see how that would fit in at all as it eventually was published.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But apparently, it was.
Well, it kind of makes sense because I could see where Shooter would be like, especially if you have this idea of each book is like a year passing in new time, you know, I mean in real time, that I can see that idea of like, oh, but if we create characters that are going to be dead in a year, like you can do things with them, and you can also avoid the whole idea of like, you know, this title's been running for 10 years. Now this character is a 40-year-old person. you know, kind of deal. So yeah. I can see where it started that way and then kind of ended up going, being developed in a different way, which is probably for the, but certainly considering the fate of the rest of the new universe, certainly for the best. But
I mean, just, I guess part of it is like, just think what it could have been like.
Yeah. Oh, oof.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But cause, yeah, there's, and I can't remember where I saw this. I think it's in an issue of, it's one of Tomorrow's magazines. They do essentially an oral history of the new universe.
Ooh.
And you just have all the editors. Not so much the creative talent, but all the editors basically saying like, oh, it was horrible.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were told we have like a budget of X, and then all of a sudden we had a quarter of X. Wow. Like overnight. But we still had to come up with 8 titles.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you have like Archie Goodwin creating Walt Simonson designing, and then none of them are on the books. Yeah. And the books are made up of like Herb Trimpe, yeah, and, you know, Jerry Conway. It's made up of, you know, dependable talent, but hardly exciting names.
Oh, yeah.
You know, cause, you know, and also, and I think again, this is the Tomorrow story, that, that Romita's basically on there as a personal favor to Shooter.
Mm.
The Shooter basically was like, come on, do me a solid.
Which makes sense. Again, cause there is a little bit of like Romita Jr. being on there and you're sort of, which is interesting cause I think actually Romita Jr. is like a pretty good match for the book, in a lot of ways.
It should be said, Romita Jr. and Al Williamson's art in the Shooter issues is really good.
You know, it's funny. I'm like, oh,
I really like it.
Yeah, yeah, no, I like it too. There's parts that I really like, and I'm not a big fan of Romita Jr.'s work during this era, but one of the things that I think is a smart choice is Romita Jr. is a comic book artist of the era. You know what I mean? Like that is a stage, yeah, where.
Well, he came off Uncanny X-Men to work in Starbrand.
Right. Well, and the things that he was doing in Uncanny X-Men, like he's someone who was like, the idea that John Romita Jr. was hanging out at a New Jersey mall somewhere and sketching what people were wearing and how people were dressing and how people were wearing their hair. Like, I feel that's really apparent in Starbrand. And it's one of the things that really, I think, works in the book's favor is that Romita Jr., the milieu that he is comfortable with and that he's closer, that he's interested in drawing generally, is closer to what Shooter is interested in portraying in Starbrand, you know?
Mm-hmm.
In that
mm-hmm.
sense, the world outside their window, they had a very similar set of windows in that thing. So I think they're actually a really, really good match in that. And like you said, and there is also some, well, but it's fascinating though, when you look at the number of Starbrand stories and Shooter's, issues that literally end on like an 8-page, like, you know, like a 9-panel grid or a 7-panel grid. Like those books are plotted weirdly and bad. Like the storytelling is just, there's some good big moments that work really well, and there's some small moments that work really well, but there's also some really fucked up weird storytelling choices where they're like, oh, okay, I've got, like, literally, I've already been told that I can draw 24 issues, and it's still not, 24 pages, and it's still enough pages for this plot. I've got to jam everything into 3, you know, 8-panel pages, the end. Like, the number of them that end on a tiny panel of Ken Connell, like, looking at, watching TV or something is just like...
Right? There's an awful lot of him watching TV.
Yeah.
Which I find hilarious. I really do like the number of times
yeah.
that Ken is just, like, sitting in front of the TV and going, huh, cool. it's a very... The other thing that Romita brings to it is, you've read some of, like, Shooter's Valiant, right?
I have to say, I don't think I have. I did not follow Shooter after he left Marvel. I mean, you know, I'm not sure that I followed Shooter as much as I followed Marvel, if you know what I'm saying. So
yeah,
like,
no,
I did
definitely
follow him. Yeah.
Because
having read those books, and don't get me wrong, like, you know, there's reasonable artists working on them. You see how much Romita brings to Starbrand. Because those books are just visually disinteresting.
Yeah.
They're not exciting. And Romita, for all his faults, does keep things moving.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, one of the things that I thought was actually amazing to me is the first issue of Starbrand opens with a splash page of Ken lifting a train that is not a, is not
a, it's not a story page.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's sort of a story thing later, but it, I realize how much I was, how much we had gotten to the point of that Marvel splash page where it's big and it's dramatic, but it's also the first page of the story. And it's very much a Silver Age throwback to have a splash page of the character doing something dramatic and dynamic. And it's not the actual, it's not an actual page of the story. I thought it was really intriguing that on the one hand, Shooter was like, well, there's a reason why you got to do this. You've got to make it visually gripping on the first page. But he was also like, but I'm not fucking interested in starting my story in a visually interesting place. Hell no, you know. Very weird, really weird.
Well, part of it is also like, I can see Shooter thinking that the motorbike heroics of the next page are visually interesting. Yeah. And, you know, Romita does what he can with them.
He really does.
But I also would not be surprised, especially because of the caption on that first page, if that first page was added later.
I think so too.
If there was a separate splash page.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it comes in and Shooter's like, no, we need something else.
There's actually a page where, Ken is fighting with the, alien in the train yard. And he's like, he's gonna kill me! And then the next page is the alien blasting, the train that Ken's holding up above himself, but you don't see him actually lift it. And I do think that actually that page might have been.
It's not because he's wearing a different outfit.
Oh, good call. Good call.
Cause I thought that as well, and I checked. It wouldn't fit into the continuity. He's wearing a different outfit.
Okay.
It's definitely a separate edition. Yeah. Or it's the same edition and they re-inked the figure to give him the outfit that he's wearing on the cover.
Right. Which, anyway. I'm like, oh man, I cannot tell you how weirded out I was by whatever Shooter was going on with those damn, with that fucking outfit. Crazy.
It's super, there's lots of things that kind of go nowhere out. Like, we concentrated very much on like, Shooter has relationship issues.
Yeah.
And Shooter's characters are very weird in such a way that like, you read into them. They don't just feel like, you know, it's a character of the story. You feel like every character is serving some purpose in Shooter's personal drama.
Yeah.
But outside of that, there's some very strange things in these comics.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that Ken has a costume that he wears and that for all the, like, I'm decrying superhero tropes, that Shooter gives Ken a costume.
Yeah.
Even just by saying, the alien has given me a copy of my biking outfit, but it's indestructible, is super interesting to me. That later on, he then makes a point of being like, there's nothing special about this costume.
Yeah, exactly.
And Deb says, no, it's special because you think it's special.
Right. Right.
You know, it's again really interesting. And again, it's not followed up on at all.
Yeah.
I actually thought this after reading Spitfire, but the more I think about it in Starbrand, it comes back again. I would love to see people try and revive these characters in terms of like literally going, okay, here's the first issue, now we'll move forward from this. But like not Marvel creators. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Like give them to someone who hasn't written like Avengers.
Yeah, I see. I kind of see what you're saying. Like, give them to indie comics creators and let them see where they're going to go with
it. And just give them the first issue and go, this is your pilot. Go forward from there.
Right. I was fascinated by the inclusion. Is it in volume 2? I guess it's in volume 2 where they include the Jeff Parker issue.
Except they don't in my Kindle version.
Really? It's not in there?
It's not in there. It says it is in the back. I have no Jeff Parker. As it is, like, I can read it on Marvel Unlimited. And I love it. I love the Jeff Parker issue because it honestly feels so much as if he's making fun of the Jim Shooter issues.
Oh, yeah. He really is. And in some ways, I sort of, part of me is a little eh about that. There's parts where he is also kind of giving them a lot more thought, I suppose. Like, you know, he does some fun stuff. Like, the Parker issue is kind of a refreshing read. And there's also kind of a little bit of a, you know, again, kind of, like you said, like, I wish someone was doing stuff with some of these characters. Like, again, there's that weird, oh, that was the other thing that I read Squadron Supreme, and I figured that would be an amazing tie-in, of course, to talking about Starbrand in the new universe, but we've already gone on long enough, so I think I'll save that for next time.
I do want to throw this in though. Burns Starbrand ends with Ken is Starbrand baby, is old man, it's a recursive loop, but like we said, he cheats.
Yes.
And where he cheats is, there's a pilot, U.S. Air Force pilot who's left with the Starbrand.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Grunwald ties that up in an issue of Quasar.
Oh God, does he? That's...
Wait, Quasar goes to the new universe. He ends up in the new universe by mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And he meets the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And the pilot essentially says, oh, I have these superpowers, but I haven't told anyone because they're freaky as fuck.
Mm-hmm.
And Quasar says, I can take the Starbrand off you, and that'll give me the power to get back to my universe. And the pilot's like, please fucking just take the superpowers.
Mm-hmm.
And gives the Starbrand to Quasar. Quasar uses them to get back to the Marvel Universe, and it's like, it burnt itself out. Now there's no more Starbrand. So yeah, he closes that, like, Grunwald years later, wow, closes the loop.
Although, does he? Because I thought the whole point is that everyone who has the Starbrand, even if they give it up, they still have 10% of what they had before. Or is that if they die? No, because that's the whole point is, right, is that Connell, of course, you know, at one point he's like, ah, ha, 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 the Starbrand kid told me Hobson's choice. Like, ha, 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 he took my power from me, but I still have 10%.
But also, that's then implied, although never stated, because why would John Byrne ever state something outright, that all of that was bullshit and it's because they're all the same person?
Oh, right. I see.
No, that's kind of undone by his, they're all the same person. Because the reason they only have 10% is because they have always had the power. They are the star brand, essentially.
Right. That's kind of
so you have that element of like, do they really have the 10% or do they just always have it and they only think they have the 10%?
Right.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Well, anyway. Interesting. I had no idea that Grunwald turned around.
Starbrand, people.
Starbrand.
It's wacky as shit.
It really is. It really is.
It's all told. It's probably one of the weirdest comics that Marvel has published. Because the first, like, the Shooter issues are so very pure in terms of creator intent.
Yeah.
In a way that, like, Marvel Comics just aren't.
Yeah.
And then it's followed by, like, three issues of fill-in, like we said, which are very weird. The Bobby Chase annual, which is super weird. And then John Byrne shitting on Jim Shooter for 9 issues. Like, it literally is, like, 7 issues of super pure intent, 9 issues of someone shitting on that intent.
Yeah, it really is. It's fascinating. It's interesting the way in which Byrne later on towards the end has Connell say things like literally like, I thought I could make a new universe, but now I see like it's important to have teams and team players and creative people who are treated like actual creatives, you know, which is hilarious. Like, cause it's
and like, it's like, I'm a cog in the machine.
It's such, exactly. It is such clumsy metatext, but it's also kind of one of those weird, it's strange. Burn's a weird guy. Shooter's a weird guy. If these were
together,
weird
they
comics,
make weird.
Holy
weird
shit.
Comic.
Yeah. If only they were weird, good comics. That would be something that would have been.
That's true. Like, it's kind of sad that, like, they're so weird and so individual and yet not good.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think it's a fascinating era, and we covered it in this episode. Hooray us. Which is my way of saying
what Jeff's saying is done.
It's been 2.5 hours, and I don't want our listeners to just die, basically. So I think
it's too late. We've talked about Starbrand for an hour and a half. They're done, everyone. I'm gonna get us out of this by saying you will find show notes for this episode and all other Raid Wad episodes and Baxter Buildings. Asterisk, since we relaunched like a couple of years ago, but you know what we're saying already. At waitwhatpodcasts.com, you will find also images of comics, maybe some Starbrand, who can even tell, on waitwhatpods.tumblr.com. waitwhatpod.tumblr.com is now auto-posting to our Twitter account. That would be at waitwhatpodcast. Jeff has a Twitter account. Nothing on a post, so there. That's at LazyBastard, at LazyBastid. I have a Twitter account, at Graham M, at GRAEMEM. And we are a Patreon-supported podcast. That's right. We are supported by loving, loving listeners like yourselves. Because I've said Patreon, Jeff has a few words.
I do. Hey, listeners, thank you so much for continuing to put up with Graham and I. That's really awesome of you. We can't even begin to tell you, really, what an impressive accomplishment it is. Although I would feel like after you finish up this episode, 2.5 hours, you're like, you know what? I did something. I did something that not everyone would do. Also, if you want to think about it in that term, there's a whole group of people who do things that even, fewer people in the world would do, which is, they actually give us a little bit of dosh, their hard-earned cash, as a way to thank us and support us and keep us motivated and interested in shooting for new and different goals. For example, the Baxter Building podcast exists, entirely as a result of the wonderful people on Patreon being like, yes, that is a stretch goal that would make everyone happy. And of course, by everyone, there's a subset there, but you know what I'm trying to say. Like I said, truly wonderful group of people on Patreon, including the kind crew at American Ninth Art Studios, as well as Empress Audrey, Queen of the Galaxy. We are especially grateful to their continuing support of this podcast, and now more than ever, their reluctance to crush the galactic wheel in which we spin and toil.
I like that you got poetic at the end there.
Yes, thank you.
People, thank you as always for listening. We will be back. In fact, I don't know when we'll be back. Jeff might have to talk about scheduling. Genuinely, I have no idea if we're back next week or if we're back in 2 weeks. Who can even tell?
Yes.
But I'll tell you this much. We very much appreciate you listening. Jeff will put in the show notes when we'll be back, because we'll have this conversation after we record. Until then, bye!